Good morning, and welcome to the April 13th, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in this morning. In the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, I will ask that you state your name, address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will open up phone lines for such comments later in today's session. This morning's meeting is a study session. The business session will start at 1 o'clock. Today we have all five commissioners on the phone, including General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, are in the boardroom. At this moment, I'd like to start off with the Pledge of Allegiance. Please join me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the
United States of America and to the Republic
for which it stands, one nation, under God,
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And normally we would be having a safety minute, but we will be skipping over that this morning. I'll move on to approval of the agenda. Commissioners, we have in front of us a consent agenda.
Gary, this is Rand.
Yes.
And maybe we should just approve the agenda as it's being introduced, but I'm wondering if we would be better served to defer our quarterly balance scorecard to our board workshop to discuss how our current status is impacting everything about that. I just thought that out as a question.
That's a very good comment, Randy. And actually, one of the things I was going to bring up during the quarterly board balance scorecard discussion was exactly that. How do we deal with meetings that have been canceled, meetings that are only conducted by phone, given the COVID-19 virus, and how should that be reflected on the scorecard? So I would throw it open to all commissioners to make comment. Do they wish to discuss that today, or would they like to discuss that in a board workshop?
I think board workshop is appropriate. And
okay.
So, I agree, this is Keith.
All right. So let's strike that off of the agenda today. That it would be the quarterly board balance scorecard workshop comments, and move that on to, and Rebecca, maybe you can be writing this down for us to keep track of it, please, to make that an agenda item for the board workshop.
I will add that to the next workshop agenda.
Wonderful. Good suggestion, Randy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Since we have any questions or any comments about the consent agenda, subject to transfer to the regular agenda? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Steve? I move we accept, this is Dennis, that we accept the agenda as presented, minus the balance scorecard.
Okay, that's been moved. Randy? Someone
I'll second that.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Any further comment on that? Hearing no comment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
It's been moved. All those against say nay. The ayes have it. Steve, can we move on to the regular agenda?
I think we can. So that'll move us to agenda item 4. Just want to check and make sure that Chad Rissman and Andy Wendell are available. We move them up a little bit here. Are you guys ready to go?
Yes, we are. Good morning, commissioners. Hope everybody's doing good. Today is April 13th, and we will be giving the quarterly load update. Myself, Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service, and my colleague here is in the room with me at the headquarters building, Chad Rissman, Director of Engineering and Asset Management. Today's topics, we'll be giving just a brief update on the 10-year load forecast. Also, I think the point of interest is COVID-19 impact. And Chad and myself will be sharing some information about what we've seen so far relative to our energy use in Chelan County relating to the COVID-19. And we'll do a quick review of the large customer projects that have come into our spectrum since January 1. And we'll give you a brief update on the substation construction activities and give an opportunity for questions. Just remind the board that there is no action requested of you today. This is information only, but we always like to hear your feedback. I'm on the slide that is titled Global Trends, Declining Energy Use. And as we assembled our load forecast team over the last 3 weeks, we thought it'd be interesting to take a look at energy use worldwide as COVID-19 kind of settled in, starting in Asia and moving to Europe and then now North America. But on this slide, you can see that in China, in the particular area, the province, that the COVID-19 really started having an impact. They saw a reduction in electric energy usage up to 21%. That was also reflected in Eastern Europe and Italy, which reported a reduction between 18 and 21%. Spain also in the 15% range. England was somewhat less at 3 to 6%. And as you move over to North America, when we assembled this information, there was limited information about what the United States was seeing. However, we know in California is reporting between a 6 and a 15% reduction. And up in Ontario, Canada, around a 10% reduction. I think you'll hear Chad talk a little bit about what we've seen on an average energy reduction within Chelan County, around 12%. So we're somewhat on par with what we've seen across the world and across the United States. I'm going to turn it over to Chad and have him talk about the slide that's titled Chelan PUD System Load March of 2020.
Good morning, commissioners, others. So a little bit describing the graph here. There's three lines that are on the graphic that are energy consumption, rates of consumption over a 24-hour period. And we selected three representative days because, as you know, in Chelan County, our loads is highly dependent on temperatures. So we chose 3 days before the COVID shutdowns and then a couple of days into it and after the shutdown, and that had similar temperature profiles throughout the day. So we felt that that would give us the best sense of any changes in the loads. I'll talk a little bit more about some of the other days comparisons, but we felt that these three dates were the most representative. So the very first one on March 2nd is the blue line, and the blue line you can see peaks. Now this is energy consumption, so you can see that about 7:30 in the morning, which is our typical time where energy consumption rate is the highest, and then it drops off towards noon and then picks up about the 5 o'clock hour. So the red line, then March 23rd, you can see that dropped quite a bit. And at the point where energy consumption was the highest was a reduction in about 50 megawatts. Now that's energy, that's at one point in time. And then March 30th, you can see that line generally followed the March 23rd line, but the peak was even lower. So some interesting things are happening. We think that this hasn't quite settled out yet, that there might be still some further reductions. But from these three representative days, I pull away three different things. First of all, the total energy over the 24-hour period is about a 12% reduction in energy for that 24-hour period. So that's the total energy for comparing these 3 days pre-COVID shutdown versus post-COVID shutdown. The other thing that's interesting is the rate at which the energy was being consumed around that typical 7:30 hour or the 8 o'clock hour ending is quite a bit lower. So although the total energy during that peak consumption drops down quite a bit, it's somewhat made up for throughout the rest of the day. So the peak is being reduced, but additional energy is being consumed throughout the day. So we think in the load forecast team thinks that this represents more of a residential profile. We think it represents a profile that is somewhat staggered. So schools out, this is a pattern that we would see like on a Saturday or a Sunday where folks aren't getting up at the exact same time and on a regimented schedule. When we look into some of the various circuits, we're seeing what we would expect to see. We are seeing commercial consumption is down quite a bit, and that the residential, general residential areas are up quite a bit. So the last thing I take away is that the peak is actually occurring 30 minutes to an hour later than what we would have seen prior to the COVID shutdown. And I think people like Eric are just sleeping in. Maybe I'll just pause on that slide for a second. I'll just pause for a second on that slide and just see if there's any questions. There's kind of a lot going on there.
So Chad, if Eric's sleeping in, the rest of us are not doing daily showers anymore.
Let's get it straight. I slept in before COVID-19.
So a little bit of a summary here. I'm on the next slide, slide 5, titled Observations During the Month of March from COVID-19. We mentioned when we're looking at those three like temperature days, we saw a reduction of about 12% in energy consumed. But as said on the next bullet point, when we looked into other days, there was as low as a 2% drop. However, the temperature profiles weren't similar. So I guess we're concluding that on peak, the highest and representative days were somewhere up in the 12% range, but on other days were as low as 2. So somewhere between 2 and 12% is what we're seeing as a reduction. And that seems to fit with some other mid-sea areas are reporting. Some of our circuits, the demand for fruit production and packaging, we're seeing some slight increases. Just looking at some of the circuits on the industrial loads are up slightly. Obviously, commercial services and looking at some of our commercial circuits, they're down. And then increases in the residential areas.
Thanks, Chad. Okay, we're moving on to the slide titled Wenatchee Foothills Housing Developments. We showed this slide during the last load forecast. We had a handful, about a half a dozen developments that were shown in the Wenatchee Foothills that were in either a pre-application status or development review status. Since that time, since January, we've had one that was revised and then three new ones that came into our planning horizon. Triad was revised to include a total of 500 residential units, a combination of cluster housing as well as single family home lots. And then moving south and west, the Philippi Farms development, very similar, 500 planned residential units, a combination of multifamily housing as well as single-family lots. There is a plan development in its early phases, 250 residential lots, actually has a restaurant in it. That is more close proximity to the city of Wenatchee or the old federal building in that neighborhood. And then we also attended a pre-application meeting for development community NADA COM for 455 residential units, multifamily housing units at the foot of 5th Street here in Wenatchee. So you could see in the lower left-hand corner over the next 3 to 5 years, if and when these developments come to full development or full build-out, it would be over 2,000 new units within the Wenatchee area. There are several other developments that have come into our planning horizon across the county as well. On the next slide, we talk about some of those, the active projects of note. I won't go through each one of those, but you can see that they're spread out between Manson and Leavenworth, Chelan, and the Wenatchee area. We have a total. We show numbers in peak megawatts for those developments, and we're talking about just under 10 megawatts for all of those developments together, and that is reflective of that 10-year forecast that has not changed at this point in time. Our 10-year load forecast remains 26 average megawatts at just over 1% per year, 1.1, 1.2% per year is what we're estimating. I just remind the commission that that hasn't changed since our last load forecast, and we felt it was premature to adjust the load forecast in response to COVID-19 until we know a little bit more about the extent of this, and we've had an opportunity to fully engage the development community and understand what may be deferred from a new construction standpoint. So more to come on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, the back to the Triad development, 500 units. Where would the access point for that be?
I believe the access point for that particular development is off of Springwater Street. Springwater, and then it'll have a secondary access through the Broadview development that exists today.
Okay.
Some of the other work trends that we've seen since January of 2020, of course, as I mentioned, we've got multiple new applications for single-family home residential line extensions. Very, very active up until new construction was limited due to the governor's orders. Increases in water line extensions for new developments. We've had a proportionally large amount of developments for our water system come into our planning arena as well. And I wanted to note that we also are looking at pre-application material with Chelan County and the developer associated with the planned Mission Ridge expansion. There's more to come on that as well. So I'm going to turn it back over to Chad, and he's going to give us a quick update on the substation. So we are on slide that is titled North Wenatchee Sub Expansion.
We've got three pictures up there. The top two you've seen already. The bottom one is construction activities related to the circuits that will tie the foundry to the new substation was in construction just prior to the COVID shutdown. That's since been paused, but there were still activities. So there's no actual construction activities. One of the themes that we're seeing with this substation-related work and all the other distribution-related work is not yet seeing an impact from equipment and supplier deliveries. So that remains to be seen if that holds true. We're We have several components and pieces of equipment that are ordered from the state of California, and they're as late as this morning letting us know that they're on schedule for their delivery. So we'll see if that holds true throughout the industry, but at least for some of our substation projects, we haven't seen that there's going to be an impact yet. So really just halting on the construction. Engineering and design work is also continued, so we're able to move forward progress on most of the substations because they were in the design and procurement phase. So at least at this point, hopeful that our impacts due to COVID delays and shutdowns on the construction side of things won't have that big of an impact, but it remains to be seen. So on to the next slide, status of substations there. Just wanted to note that not necessarily because of COVID impacts, but we're for the most part on schedule. As I mentioned before, we were in the design and procurement phase for most of the substations. The Chelan Gorge, North Shore, Leavenworth, and the mobile substations, those were slipping into, I had previously reported as quarter one, but they're slipping into the next quarter, but not necessarily because of COVID delays, but just because of projects and deliveries were taking a little bit longer. But I expect those projects to continue to be on track.
Chad, this is Dennis. I've been out, my escape from my house is to occasionally with my wife get in one of our cars and just drive around and look at the blossoms. And we headed south on Wenatchee about a week ago. I ended up in the Malaga area. Seems like quite a bit of development in there. My thought at the time was our substation in that area or substations in that area, are they adequate for the amount of development that appears to be occurring in the southern section of the county?
That's a great question, Commissioner. Thank you. We have on our plan, it's outside of what we've got listed on this sheet, but we're actively identifying potential options for two additional substations, one down in the Rock Island area, and then another one closer to the train yard or the bottom of Stamilt. We're actively looking at potential areas, and then we'll be engaging the board and the community to try to make some site selections. But to answer your question, no, we don't have adequate substation capacity to meet the what we forecast the demands of being in the greater Malaga area.
Okay, yeah. It was just kind of surprising in that Ravens or whatever it is had kind of gone dormant, but it seems to be coming back to life. And, just was surprised at the amount of development.
I live out in Malaga, and that road just seems like every month the traffic increases on that road. So,
yeah,
I'm seeing that too.
Yeah, thank you.
So just wrapping up, some of our strategic views from a load forecasting perspective that will continue in 2020 is one of the big ones is continuing to engage with the development community, both economic development, residential development, commercial, industrial development. That's both a public and private effort, and we certainly will continue to perform direct outreach with those stakeholders. We're trying to get a better understanding of the long-term impacts of COVID-19 in terms of energy and, most importantly, how that impacts our plans for our infrastructure and how do we continue to meet the development needs with that infrastructure. So it's when I look into that crystal ball right now, it is not clear. It's very foggy, but we're keeping it close. We're continuing to look at it very closely on a regular basis. So we'll have more to come in the next load forecast meeting. Additionally, we're closely monitoring our trends to make that 10-year adjustment more appropriate. We know that there's a lot of decisions that are derivatives of that 10-year load forecast. So we want to bring the best information forward as possible, and we'll see you again in Q2 for that forecast. So just summarizing, say that as Chad had articulated, that we've seen up to a 12% decline in average energy over those 3 days that we talked about in our system. So we're somewhere, if you were to look at the month of March, we're somewhere between 2 and 12%. Growth in new construction, most of our construction in Chelan County is essentially on pause. However, there's indications that some may be picking up over the next 3 to 4 weeks as restrictions may be lifted slightly. Our engineering groups are keeping in close contact with those developers. We've made minor adjustments to our 2020 load forecast. However, that 10-year forecast remains at 26 average megawatts and just over 1% per year. As Chad had talked about, we've realized some shifts from the small commercial, small business areas of our energy and moved out into more loads in the residential sectors. And then those regional planning efforts will allow us to continue to adjust our forecast moving forward. So with that, are there any other questions before we close?
Yeah, Dave, this is Gary. I just wanted to make a comment more than anything else. I've been watching economic news unfold here, and one of the things that has caused a little bit of concern on my part when it comes to the projection for these developments that you were showing, and that banks, starting with large banks, but surely going to be rolling down to smaller banks as well, have tightened up their loan standards, not wanting to get caught as they did in 2008, making it much more difficult in order to acquire a loan for development. So I will be interested to see and kind of follow what you guys discover with those projects, whether or not they get put on hold or whether they do actually take place.
Yeah, Commissioner, those are good points, very good points. I would just mention the slide on Wenatchee Foothills housing developments. Those developments are in various stages. Some of them are just in the conceptual planning phase. Other ones have actually moved into the breaking of the ground and actual construction. So it will be interesting to see. And again, I want to ensure the commission knows that we're having direct conversations with the individual developers and investors in these plans as well. So to try to better understand what we can anticipate in the next year or over the next 5 years.
Great. Thank you. Commissioners, any other comments?
Hey, thank you, guys. Appreciate the presentation. I think now we're ready to move on to agenda item 5, which is an update on the debt action plan. Heather Ireland will be presenting.
Good morning. This is Heather Ireland, Lead Treasury Analyst for Chelan PUD. This morning, no action is requested. This is just a progress update to keep the board informed of our potential bond issuance plan. On slide 2, I have a few items to update the board on in regards to some recent actions and current market conditions. The first is on Friday.
I apologize.
but I'm not seeing this in my board packet. Was there an update that I did not get downloaded?
I can double check real quick.
If everybody else has it, I must have missed that.
Randy, it's number five on your board packet, board bond issuance update.
Yeah, what I'm looking at, it's on my agenda, and I have under the study session items 3, 4, 6, 6, and 6, and there's none of them that speak to bond action.
No, well, if you don't have a 5, then it's not on there.
Okay, go ahead. I can listen.
Hey, Commissioner Smith, this is Kirk. I don't know if you have Board Effect handy, but it's on page 21 of Board Effect, the meeting book.
I'm viewing the meeting book.
So the board book in Board Effect was updated late Friday, so if you haven't re-downloaded it since late Friday, it won't show in your current version. You'll just need to upload the most recent version of the packet.
Okay. Well, go ahead, and I'll do that while you're doing that.
Okay, I'll go ahead and continue. But the slides aren't super interesting. There's really not a lot of pretty pictures on them.
Okay, all right.
For some recent actions that have occurred, the first one is that on Friday, April 10th, we did, moving forward on our preliminary tentative timeline, we did publish the district's preliminary official statement and also an investor presentation. Those documents are the offering documents that will be circulated in the investment community for potential investors to make decisions around if they would like to purchase bonds. In addition to those being posted on Friday, last week, and really over the last 10 days, we've been doing some outreach to potential local selling group members and also customer owners that we know have expressed an interest in purchasing bonds. So that has also been occurring. And in addition, we did were able to post a notice of potential bond issuance on the district's website, and that was done on April 3rd. So all of that has been in preparation of issuing bonds, again, on our tentative timeline. So we were happy to be able to achieve some of those steps. Another big achievement in this process is we did provide updates to both S&P and Fitch in regards to our upcoming bond issuance and also final year-end results from 2019. And both agencies have rated the new bond issuance at a AA+ level and also affirmed ratings on our other bonds. So that's a great outcome. We were really happy to see that. It really reflects all of the district's efforts over the last years to keep focused on maintaining operational and financial health and mitigate risks. So we really feel like that puts the district in a great position, especially in current markets. Situations like what's going on today in markets is exactly why having high-quality bond ratings is really important to the district. It ensures that we can have access before others. And also still achieve reasonable rates. We do know that with current market conditions, we are planning to stay flexible on timing, but continue moving forward. Other issuers are also doing the same, and we're monitoring that to see if increases in supply are meeting demand in the market without overwhelming or shocking the system. There has been some recent information released from the Federal Reserve that, while not directly impactful to the district's borrowing, is supportive of increased supply in the market, and that's favorable to the district because the more support of supply means the more likelihood that we will be able to achieve desirable rates. Also, the district, now that we have published our preliminary official statement and are ready to potentially price and sell bonds next week, we are also ahead of many other issuers that are now just beginning to look at the market and making decisions around whether or not they would like to move forward. In addition, as I've mentioned before, we're in a position where while we would like to issue bonds to achieve savings, we are not in a situation where we have to issue bonds to support our operations or capital plan. And that's very beneficial to the district because it means that we would only be issuing bonds to capture those savings and not because we have to. all of those reasons center around flexibility being key, which is really where the district is at. And moving on to the timeline that's on slide 3, again, today is just an update with no action requested. We do plan in April to tentatively price and sell bonds on April 21st. And then we would anticipate that if that does occur as scheduled, we would be circling back with the board targeted for April 27th for signing of closing documents. And then in May, May 1st, we're targeting completing the bond issuance and delivering the actual bonds and receiving proceeds. So I wanted to pause there and ask if there's any questions about the bond issuance process.
Commissioners, comments, thoughts? Heather, I'll just make one comment, and that is extremely pleased to see the Fed step in and infuse capital into capital markets to help the bond market, particularly the municipal market. It looked like things were going to seize up there, and obviously they greased the slides pretty well.
Yes, we did see some definitely positive movement in the market last week.
Okay, assuming there are no further questions, Heather, thank you very much for that update, and we'll keep the board updated next week if we go to pricing, see how that works out. With that, we're ready to move on to a series of COVID-19 presentations. We've got actually three pieces on the agenda, and I'm going to add one other piece that is in the board packet. It's a graphic that attempts to describe how we are thinking about the management challenges of dealing with COVID-19. I think it also has some applicability to what ultimately are the economic challenges, but it really wasn't put together for that purpose. It was put together to think about how we balance public and employee health and being able to accomplish that while at the same time accomplishing providing reliable utility services. So we felt like it was important to describe a mental model of where we have been and where we're trying to go to. So if you look at the graph that's identified as COVID-19 in Chelan County, the risk phases, there are six phases that are described here. Phase one is really sort of late February, maybe even a little bit into early March, when we became aware of how people think about infection risk and the risk of a peak level of infection and then trying to flatten the curve. That was the point when we were seeking to eliminate travel and beginning to move people to work remotely. Phase two, and you follow this graph by going down to phase two, what we call the act immediately phase, was the middle of March, when we got a lot of input from the local healthcare community leadership that we were at risk of having the peak infection occur very quickly, even within the next 2 weeks. And so our picture looked somewhat like the original graph that went very and that was the point at which we really moved to aggressively send people home to work remotely, and then also stopped the work that could not be performed remotely unless it could be performed with social distancing. And that shut down most of the field operations work, good portion of it anyway. Phase three is where we are now, where it appears that the curve has been flattened, and it's been a month since we thought we might be headed towards peak infection, which is coming very quickly. We're still thinking that peak infection is somewhere 1 to 2 weeks out in Chelan County. So we're now thinking that we're seeing a lower peak, a delayed peak, but a longer peak. So concerned about having to go through the plateau phase that we think may be going off through the end of May And that is causing us to rethink our strategies. We're beginning this week, beginning to bring back some of our field operations folks, but only if we can find new ways to do their work in which social distancing can be accomplished. So we're looking at new technology, new PPE, new work practices that would allow us to get some of this work done. Essentially, back in phase two, we used a blunt instrument to just stop work, and now we're trying to use a more refined instrument to at least bring some folks back, because we're developing a backlog, particularly with respect to critical maintenance, that's going to be tough to dig out of. Down the road, maybe as early as late May, early June, we expect to be in a different place where we're on the downslope, dealing with the kinds of issues that we see in the countries that have gone before the U.S., where you begin to reopen, loosen things up, but it doesn't go back to normal. And it doesn't go back to normal because you're worried about phase five. Phase five is a graph from the Imperial College data that has been widely used that expresses the risk of rebound, that you come off the peak and you loosen up too much and you rebound and you bounce back and forth for who knows how many times. But until you finally get to phase six, when a vaccine is available or some therapies that can mitigate the risk of infection for folks who have already gotten the infection. So it's either prevent or reduce risk after you get the infection. Hopefully then we get back to what we're describing as a new normal. We kind of doubt it's going to go all the way back to the way things were before March, but hopefully it'll look more like March than certainly what we have going on today. A lot of that depends on good tests and as well as vaccines too. So that's our overall thought about how this will play out. You can see that we're still really in the middle of this and certainly learning as we go. It's probably the most aggressive adaptive management system I've seen, trying to bring information, understand what our healthcare community leadership is telling us, and being able to act upon. Any questions about that before we move on? Okay, then next up, we want to move to Andrew Grissel. He's going to talk about the follow-up to the last board meeting on individual and small business concerns. Let me preface this, though, by saying that we have not really spent much time in this presentation on two things that the board and we talked about following up on. First is the postponement of the rate increase that was scheduled for the end of June. That's included in a resolution that the board will take up this afternoon. And second, there is delegated authority to the general manager to on fees and charges. We had already made the decision to implement no cutoffs and no late fees through the end of April. We are now planning to extend that through the July. Going back to that roadmap that we just went through, our sense is that hopefully by the end of May or June, things are loosening up and we're beginning to be able to get people back to work. And we added a month to that schedule just to say it's going to take a while for people to get back to work. So at this point, we are moving ahead with that. Of course, the board can always change that if it wants to, but acting under your delegated authority, that's our plan. Andrew, would you please jump in now?
You bet. Thank you. Okay, I'm on the – good morning, commissioners. I'm on the presentation title, Washington Required Shutdown, Utility Customer Impacts and Program Solutions, April 13, 2020. Today I'm here providing an update on customers impacted by the COVID-19 state shutdown. The team that enabled such a quick turnaround on this request includes Andy Wendell, Kerry Wendell, Josh Mitchell, Sean Seaman, and Hassan Shaban from Empower DataWorks. They're also on the line to help answer any specific questions you may have as we move forward with the presentation. Moving to slide two. This presentation is in response to your request for additional information on the impact of the state shutdown to our community of individual and business customers. We're going to provide information on the impact of COVID-19 shutdown on our customers. We're going to share information on what we are currently doing. We're going to share some information on what others are thinking. We're going to discuss potential additional actions PG can take to support customers impacted by the state shutdown. And then with that, Eric will later lead a discussion later in the presentation when we discuss what may or may not be able to do within our statutory authority. And so as we're moving through these things, just keep that in the back of your mind. We are not requesting any actions from the board today, but your feedback is greatly appreciated as we move forward with looking through different options. So we'll move to slide three. Overall, the Clinton County unemployment claims are up significantly over the last several weeks. I can see that prior to the shutdown, claims were way down below, probably 250, 175. After the shutdown, there's been a couple waves. The first wave was in hospitality and restaurants, bars, retailers, those that were deemed not essential quickly. Then in the next wave, there were claims coming from our residential, commercial construction, other supporting services. These trends have are similar moving into the week of March 29th and April 4th. More construction loss, job losses, more support service losses, but with fewer hospitality losses because most of those occurred within the first that first wave. Currently, we have about 5,285 individuals in Chelan County that have filed for unemployment, and this is 12% of our labor force, so it's a significant impact on our local labor force. We move to slide four. I want to provide some context around small, large businesses, what we can expect from impact for each of those groups. And so this slide provides a summary of business sizes compared to whether or not a business is deemed essential. Basically, what you're seeing on the graph is more small businesses by proportion are considered non-essential, while the larger businesses are considered essential. This is important, I think, because it's assumed that the smaller businesses, the ones more likely to be shut down, are probably also at risk from a cutoff in their revenues. They just simply don't have the size nor the resources available to weather a prolonged shutdown or a prolonged basically having their revenues cut to almost zero. And so that's providing more sort of context with what we are looking at and discussing. So you'll see that as we're moving forward, thinking about these small businesses, that's really in these groups that are, under 250 employees, and especially the 1 to 4, those small sole proprietorships are getting hit much harder. We move to slide five. This is more detail, moving into more detail of our customers and what's been going on. This slide summarizes customer call stats and provides a picture of what our stakeholder relations team is working on. We see that there have been some successes with staff when we contact customers. Almost 300 customers that were contacted have either paid or made some sort of payment arrangement. Staff have been able to contact around 90 customers. This is where the customers have been reached out to via phone call, and those customers have not responded back to us.
Andrew?
Yeah.
I'm just curious if the numbers that you're seeing this year vary a lot from previous years.
Great question. Carrie, are you on?
Yes, I'm on.
Okay. Could you talk to that? Could you speak to that, please?
Well, I would say part of the group of 90, the no success customers, I think that's pretty typical of that because our credit and collection group spends a lot of time making phone calls, going through that normal credit and collection process with the door hangers and the disconnects. So most of these are typical, to answer your question, yes.
Is is that true on the contacted with the roughly almost 300 customers too?
Yes, that is typical.
Okay, so those numbers are. Then I think
Gary,
one thing.
So, as long as we're looking at the numbers, this is Gary, by the way. Customers contacting the PUD with a hardship, are those numbers, that 130, is that normal?
Those are actually the numbers that have contacted us that are actually impacted by the COVID. There hasn't been, we've been tracking those separately whenever there's a job loss, because these are not our typical customers. These are our customers that it's a temporary change, and they've contacted us.
Of those commercial, the 20 commercial, is there any kind of a way of determining, are they all resident restaurants, or what type of business does that represent?
It ranges from everything, Gary. It's every customer has a different work issue right now, so it's everywhere in Chelan County that we're getting the calls.
No, I was focusing just on the commercial, the 20.
Oh, those, the 20, yes, most of those are restaurants, small
okay,
businesses.
Thank you.
Yes. And just so you know, that number has jumped up to 170, because this was as of April 6th, and last week we received another 49 customers that have contacted us, so we're up to 168 as of Friday.
That's a big piece of information. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And is it are they split the same way, residential and commercial, or is that pretty much all residential?
Mostly residential from last week, but there are a few.
Okay,
commercial.
Thank you, Carrie. And then the last piece of information on the slide is looking at revenues past due. And we can also see that from year over year, the revenue that's past due has increased on both the residential and the commercial side. Another piece of information to show what's going on out there with our customers and what types of calls and the information that our customer relations staff are taking, as well as the types of customers they're helping. So the next two slides provide a summary of what has been heard from commercial customers. We've seen some of the staff, and now it's getting out there talking with the customers. What are we hearing? And in general, utilities are not a huge driver of their expenses, but they mention that every little bit helps. I think generally right now they're concerned with a lot of the uncertainty around state and federal programs, concerned around the timing of those programs, the paperwork of their programs, and they're not really sure of the full impact at this time. So it's been hard for them to verbalize and to communicate where they need help the most. And it's really, I think, important to continue to keep talking with those customers and speaking with them, that as things change, we're able to respond to those changes or think about those changes in the context of how we are moving forward with potential programs to help them. And so, there's just they're not sure when they're going to reopen. The dates keep getting pushed back, as you saw from the information from what Steve just presented, looking late May, June time periods, that things may start opening up a little bit. That uncertainty is really weighing down on the small, especially the small commercial customers and the small business customers. And I have this next slide, slide 7, and because there's differences, and there's depending on whether the business is essential or not, it's almost like a tale of two cities. Some at the best of times, but for many, many, the worst of times. You see the essential businesses, the grocery store, they've tripled their revenue as people are stocking up on their supplies. Some companies are able to work on a backlog of projects that they've had. They can do this remotely. But then we have small businesses. businesses that, you know, they have revenues that are down to zero. And or even if they're open, they're barely making what they would make and what they would normally expect to make. And so I think having that perspective and hearing from that to them is very important as we move forward. Slide 8. Is a slide. So what are the order of magnitude of the bills that we're looking at? This slide summarizes the April and May average commercial and residential bills from 2019 for electricity, water, and wastewater. I think one of the silver linings on this is occurring during the shoulder months where energy usage is generally lower. The bills aren't quite as high as normal. And so, you know, any programs or any help the customers need, it goes further during this time. On the other hand, you know, we still have, you know, water and wastewater customers that have, you know, bills on the, especially on the commercial side, that are bigger. And so, you know, moving forward, what programs do we develop? How do we provide a support to customers with the bills that they have?
Andrew,
slide 9. Unless there's any questions, I'm going to pause just a minute. I've been talking for a couple slides, so let me pause for a minute and see if there's any questions on what we've seen.
Andrew, this is Gary. I have a question back on slide 8.
Okay, move back.
So the question is for your average, which is April, May, residential electric, $42.75. If you, what is the annual average for residential electric?
Gary, this is Andy Wendell. The annual average for residential is right at $56 a month.
Okay, great. And do we have, is there such a thing as a commercial average?
Our commercial is, I want to be cautious because our commercial service, our rate schedule is so broad, from almost, in some cases, very, very low consumption, all the way up to large accounts. But I believe the average, annual average, is around $255 a month. But I can get back to you on that with more accuracy as well.
Well, Andrew, and you know, there's, is there a way to break it out to say small business compared to large business, you know, and have two sets of numbers?
Yeah, I think we can slice and dice that a little bit more to give you a better perspective.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hi, this is Steve. Back on, and I hate to jump back so far, but the question just keeps coming up for me on slide 5 on the revenue past due. Is there any concerns with the increases in past due amounts from 19 to 20? And are those figures skewed because of COVID, or is that just, are we just seeing those increases?
Steve, this is Carrie. That's a good question. What I see in these numbers and what we're seeing in these numbers is this is how much that normally would be past due if we did not follow the normal credit and collection processes, because right now we spend a lot of time this time of the year especially collecting on these amounts. And so our servicemen leave door hangers. We're a little bit tougher with our credit collections. And actually, since March, we haven't done any disconnects since March 9th. And so it's been a month since we've actually worked through the full credit collection process. So that's why these numbers show such a big change, I believe, at this point.
Great. Thank you.
As we know, that's changing, but right now that's where the main changes.
Sure. Understandable. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Great. Thank you. All right. Well, back on slide 9 now. And so with all of this information, how do we start sorting through who and how to help? If you recall, Josh discussed the concept of energy burden a couple weeks ago. And if you remember, this is an energy bill divided by the income. So what we've done is we've further segmented this data to levels of energy burden with the assumption that those with the highest energy burden are likely still those that are most in most need. And so we're looking at a plus 8%, a 6 to 8%, and then something we call a borderline, which is 4 to 6%. It is also important, though, to remember that this is from data prior to the state shutdown. So customers that may have been borderline before could very well be in the high range, or those that weren't even on the border could now be at risk. And you know, that's information we don't have available at this time, but just want to keep that in the back of people's minds as well. You'll also notice that the borderline to very high energy burden, there's about a $6 difference, and that driver, of course, is the income. And so as you move down in the income levels, even though the average monthly bills are sort of similar, the actual energy burden increases with that. We also did some work around home ownership and mobile home utilization among this group. That was a question from the board at the last presentation as well. And so you can see the both the counts as well as the percent energy burden from those who rent, those who own, as well as those renters that make under 80% of the area median income, what their count is, their monthly bill, and average energy burden, providing a picture of ways we can look at the information and how the bills are impact the overall expenses of those customers. I will stop there for a second for questions. Okay. Move forward to slide 10. Slide 10 is our commercial customer segment, and we tried to really look at both the number of customers that were considered small businesses and also considered non-essential, and looking at their bills. We also looked at small businesses and industries driven by discretionary spending, so residential or non-food retail, looking at it from that perspective. So those would be, you know, those aren't exclusive of the 2,700. Some of those customers are within that number. And then, you know, going on the other direction, large facilities that could be hit by a drop in tourism. So looking at theaters, art centers, convention centers, hotels, what the number of those customers and what their average monthly bill was in the month of during 2019. Those provides us with a look at potential small businesses that could be impacted, what the size of that the bills are, potentially looking at some sort of order of magnitude of impact. And then did want to mention a note that at least as of last week, we had not received any customers from the large facilities. We hadn't received calls from any customers from the large facilities regarding their bills or anything at this point in time. And so I'm going to take a stop here on this slide as well and see if there are questions. I will also say that there's questions on data and some of those information Sasan is also on. And so he can provide any information on more detailed data. Okay. Move forward to slide 11. In this slide, the diagram provides a way of looking at what we are doing or what we could do. We are at the level of what we're calling level one today. These are our existing programs. We have payment arrangements. As Gary has mentioned, we're not disconnecting any customers and we're not instituting any late fees. There is a low income energy assistance program through Community Action. There's also our Helping Hand program, which is our donor program. Moving to the next level, there's partial assistance for qualifying customers. So this would be, you know, everything in level one. And then we also have on there a deferral of rate increase, which is up for board consideration later today. So that's one of the items that we would consider a level two. And then there's, moving down on, there's, you know, more and more as far as our touch with the customers. So there's bill credits, discounts, deferrals, forgiveness, and then going even further than that, there's waiving of, connection fees, incentives for new or restarting businesses. And, levels 2 and 3 are potential actions that could be taken. And Eric will also provide in an upcoming slide, provide more legal discussion around what are the risks to the districts of some of the different concepts, at a conceptual level, and those actions. And so we'll have he'll provide us with the board with information and a discussion on that. And so I wanted to stop here for a moment. I'm on slide 12. This slide provides us with a little more information on our current district-related programs that are in place today. And we'll go through all of them. I will do want to call out a couple because they're kind of alike, but not quite. And so we encourage our customers, if they need to apply with Community Action for low-income home energy assistance programs. And it's important because they've changed some of their criteria. Prior LIHEAP program qualifications were 3 months of income data and benefits up to $500 a year. What they're doing now is in order to account for some of the COVID layoffs, is they're only looking at 1 month of income qualification. And if customers already had it, $500 a year, they could get an extra $500. And if they haven't applied at all before, they can get up to $500 in the energy assistance programs. And then we also have a Helping Hand program, which is a program that that can be used to help customers enduring financial hardships. And we generally limit that to about $200 per household per year. And that's our donor program. Those are funds that are donated by our community, by other customers. And so those two programs are here and available for our residential customers.
Andrew, this is Ann.
Yes.
I have a question about your last statement. So you said that generally Helping Hand is limited to $200 a year. So you look at the total amount that's donated and then just take that and spread it out and limit it $200 a year. Spread it out through the year, correct? Or is that a one-time payment?
Carrie, is that one time, or is it kind of, how do you generally look at that?
Actually, the Helping Hand is just limited to $200 per household per year. It's not really looking at the contributions that are coming in to base that. Yeah. That's just a number that we went off probably 10 years ago.
So I guess my thought is, would it be possible to look at the overall Helping Hand donation countywide and increase that that limit of $200 per household, increase that now during this time of need, and then at a later time? I mean, I guess what I'm unclear of is if it's something that's done once a year, and what time, what part of that year, can we change that calendar of how it's done and how much people could receive right now if they could get more now and maybe a little less later or something?
Carrie, this is Eric. You want me to take a shot at that?
Sure.
So Commissioner Congdon, in a couple of pages, we're going to go through some buckets of what I call buckets of types of relief that the district is evaluating with the sole purpose, really, of addressing a lot of the issues that Andrew and the team have been talking about in this particular presentation and try to get the appropriate relief out to those customers that need it. One of the issues that I'll be discussing, which we can do now, is the issue of whether and how the district can either expand its existing programs like Helping Hand or potentially even start a new program administered by a third party or even the district, which would supplement the Helping Hand assistance. There are some pros and cons, both legally and practically, to both of those. The Helping, and we'll talk more about it in a moment, but the Helping Hands program being long established with some parameters, we can certainly evaluate those parameters and adjust them to the extent it's appropriate. There are some limitations on the Helping Hands, like they go to residential customers, not commercial. So we can either...
That's what I was considering. I'm not looking to create a whole new program and have the, you know, the administrative costs and the time and so forth with our, you know, for our staff who's already behind. We're falling behind every day on projects. And so just wondering if we can tweak and make the Helping Hands program that's already set up, established, we have the money coming in, tweak that to make it work a little better right now. But I guess we'll get into that. Sounds like in a few pages. That's fine. Thanks, Barry.
You bet.
And slide 13. On top of what we're currently doing, there are also some non-utility assistance. What we're calling non-utility assistance for individuals, increased unemployment benefits. There's cash grants. There's many mortgage lenders are proactively offering some sort of options for their customers. For small businesses, the CARES Act provided for some payroll protection, provided for disaster loans. They also, for everyone, we have delayed tax filing dates. And then the Small Business Administration has something called an economic injury disaster loan as well. And a lot of these loans, that if the dollars are spent on what's considered qualifying expenses, that they can actually turn into a grant at some point. Now, some of the challenges with some of these is that they're taking time to get implemented, and a lot of the small businesses have cash flow problems. And so it seems like there's help out there for them, but it's out a little ways. And, you know, are there things that we can do to help in the meantime get them to those points? And so those will be some of the items that we'll be talking about in just a little bit.
Andrew, this is Randy.
Yeah.
I just wanted to really point out the first item on there, the unemployment benefits increased by $600 a week to those that have lost their jobs. It's not increased to, but by. And current unemployment benefits in our state for a minimum wage employee are probably $200 to $300 a week, or maybe more. I know it varies. I'm really familiar with it, unfortunately, as an employer. But there's a lot of people that have lost their jobs in the restaurant industry here in the Wenatchee Valley. With this, we'll get a dramatic raise for not working. That's a really important thing for us to understand.
Yes, I think that's a great point, and that's a point that we had discussed too as we were putting this together. Is that, you know, and we'll talk to you a little bit about it in the summary. But for individuals, you know, a lot of it's not going down to zero revenue. Some of it they're being, you know, for some of it, like you said, they may get above, but a lot of it, you know, maybe other folks that make more, they'll be getting some percentage. So they're not going down to zero, and so. There are some programs out there, and I think it's important for people to understand it to know that. So that's the point well taken. So slide 14, principles we are considering. These are, as we sift through all this information and we look to potentially develop additional customer support actions, we want to ensure we have constant, consistent guidance. And so these are some principles we're looking behind, and I'll just quickly read through them. And, you know, our overarching, determine what is the best for the most for the longest. That's something we do with all the work that we do. We want to maintain our commitment to meet financial metrics. You know, the benefit of that, of course, is the presentation we just heard from Heather on our bond ratings, as well as being able to, you know, have funds available to help if need be. Do our part to help our community during a time of need where we can under our statutory authority, looking to make it meaningful and impactful to those that are in need. We also want to ensure, you know, equal access to all our customers and commit to reach our entire diverse community. We want to minimize our administrative burdens, implement it at the right time so that we're helping our customers when they need help. And then, of course, through all of this, we need to, you know, keep our pulse on our customers, talk with them, see how they're doing so that we can measure and address as needed. I'm going to stop there and see if those all seem to hit the right note with the commissioners. Okay. We're moving over to the legal overview of some potential customer support options, and for that, I'll hand it over to Eric.
Thanks, Andrew. Commissioners, I'm going to start on page 15. So, not surprisingly, maybe lawyers don't like change because change means risk and issues to resolve. Not surprisingly, under the COVID response, the legal team has been very busy evaluating lots of legal issues, but one series of issues that we've been spending a particular amount of time on is associated with this presentation. What kinds of buckets of options are available to the district should it choose to step in and try to provide support for its customer owner rate payers as they struggle through the impacts of the COVID-19 circumstances. So from a legal perspective, the three big issues that face the district that the lawyers evaluate are ones that you're well familiar with given your time here at the district. There are the gifting or anti-gifting issues that we face. There are the authority issues and the nexus to the district's purpose. And then the third is the implementation of any assistance or program in a way that is equitable, and by that I mean non-discriminatory to any customers within the rate classifications that the commissioners have established, unless there's a specific ability like low-income disabled seniors that is particularly recognized by statute or constitutional provision, and we have an opportunity to treat those folks a little bit differently. So the bullet points on page 15 really represent what I refer to as buckets of potential areas of support for customer owners. Some of them we've already acted upon and we believe are clearly within the district's authority. Others raise more questions and concerns. So if you'll bear with me, the highlighted portions here. So clearly, these are high-level buckets, and these are statements of authority generally. As we finish the conversation and analysis internally, and we'll be continuing that conversation with staff and then ultimately with the district and the commissioners, we do need to remember the devil will be in the details as to how we would develop, design, and implement any relief process. But so clearly, forbearance at low or no cost to customers is within the PUD authority. We've already implemented those measures. You've heard about them. The board has previously delegated fees and charges responsibility to the general manager. Steve has acted upon some of those. Clearly, we are evaluating under bullet number two different types of rate relief that would be available to customer classes. The district, through its board, sets rate classifications and rate amounts, and the district through its board can take actions to provide rate relief. The reminder here is that we would need to do that in an equitable and non-discriminatory fashion within the rate classifications that have been established. So we're evaluating alternatives there as well. Rate relief to low-income residential customers, that is within the PUD authority. We already have programs in place, and we're evaluating what else we can do to provide low-income support for those in need as a result of the COVID circumstance. The question has come up of whether we could, as a district, provide targeted rate relief to individual commercial or industrial customers based upon whatever their particular set of circumstances is in their business. This is actually pretty problematic for the district because we begin to take into account specific instances and circumstances applicable to a customer individual as opposed to those types of customers or classifications of customers generally. This invokes the equitable and non-discriminatory issues. So those are more challenging and problematic. That doesn't mean that we've given up on those ideas. In fact, we're having conversations between the legal team and subject matter experts within the district about how and whether we can provide any more targeted relief. And some of these cross over because some of that targeted relief may be related to rate relief in terms of tweaking or changing some sort of rate classification or structure should that seem to be the right approach as we move through the COVID response. And then the last bullet clearly is we can provide customers through funds donated by other customers. That is within PUD authority. This bullet is directed specifically to the Helping Hands program that was established by the board as near as we can tell in 1990. We're actually still struggling to find some of the old resolutions establishing that program, and whatever the sideboards are for eligibility, that's one of the difficulties in addressing head-on Commissioner Congdon's question earlier, which is can we go tweak all those sideboards? We have a pretty good working relationship and understanding with the administrator of that program as to how customers would qualify and how they could administer that program, and Carrie's group handles that. In order to tweak those officially, we need to figure out what they really are, and we're struggling to find that resolution, but Lisa has assured me if it's out there and exists, we'll find it. So that is something that we are evaluating. That question was raised by Commissioner Bowles at the last meeting, Commissioner Congdon today, and I just want to assure the board that one of the things that we are spending a significant amount of time on is reviewing the district's ability to make contributions or set up programs for customers that have this need and what that looks like, whether that's making contribution through existing programs like Helping Hands. I would say that it does appear that the district has the authority to set up programs and probably, assuming we administer it correctly, to contribute to those low-income programs like Helping Hands. We are still evaluating some of the outstanding issues surrounding those kinds of programs, and frankly, would it be better to contribute through an existing program, as Commissioner Congdon was talking about earlier, or whether it would be easier actually to set up a separate program with different parameters that might be more expanded. So we're still looking at that. There are limitations to the Helping Hand program. I would say that there are those at the district who believe that since 1990 that's been a pretty successful program, and we don't want to tweak too much that program because we're going to want that program to continue in perpetuity into the future instead of and then we would have to tweak it back. So there is some burden associated with that. There are limits within that program as to who qualifies, the scope of the qualifications. Specifically, residential is the target of that program. It does not target commercial, and we would have the possibility, as other utilities have looked at, to try to respond to some of the commercial need through a temporary program that might look similar, might look a little different from Helping Hands. But there are a number of questions, in addition to the resource and administration questions that Commissioner Congdon raised in her comments as well, which are also legitimate questions that we're trying to address internally through the not only the legal team, but the subject matter experts and the folks who would have to establish and administer that program. I want to pay great compliment to Carrie Wendell and her team. Actually, Carrie and her team every year work directly with customers who struggle, and they're very skilled at it, and so skilled, frankly, that often the board and the district staff doesn't hear about it. They go into some of those collection measures that Carrie mentioned earlier today, and we get those dollars in the long run for the most part. So Their ability to administer a program also ties into that particular potential solution. So I do want to assure the board that we are looking at all of these issues for the authority. These are some big buckets of issues and types of response that we could provide. So far, we believe that we have the ability to work fairly nimbly within most of these buckets. The targeted bucket is the most difficult one simply because of the ability to set up a program that would be equitably administered across a rate classification that's already established, depending upon particular circumstances of particular customers that, frankly, were outside of and not considered as part of the particular rate classification. But I would say the big one right now that we are working on is the last bullet as well, with respect to the Helping Hands versus the some other program, and what that looks like, and what we think the most effective solution would be for whatever this interim period of time is that the district finds itself in, trying to address the needs of its customers who are responding, each and every one, perhaps differently under the COVID circumstances. So I want to offer an opportunity for commissioners and others to ask questions about these buckets and whether there's anything they see as missing. I will say that a lot of the particulars, the details, are still under discussion in the district, so we don't have today a planned presentation or recommendation about how we would design these programs and administer and implement them, but I want to check in with the board and say, do we have the right kinds of or buckets of potential relief listed, or is there something that is missing that you've thought of? So I do want to invite then each board member, if you have questions or ideas, I'm always happy to receive phone calls or answer them offline. Each of you have my cell number. It's on all the time. So please feel free to call if you have specific questions or concerns about any of these or any others that you've thought about or heard about.
Go ahead, Dennis.
Go ahead. Yeah, Eric, this is Dennis. Just to let you know, kind of a head nod, that I think we're moving in the right direction. The buckets seem appropriate. The research seems appropriate. And ultimately, to create the, or to identify the nexus of what would allow us to do what it is we determine we need to do, the effort to identify that is much appreciated. So I'm saying I think we're moving, in my opinion, in the right direction.
Thanks, Commissioner. Commissioner Arsenault, do you have a question?
Yes, I did, Eric. Thank you. And the question was, do you know if Helping Hands distributes 100% of the proceeds that we give them now, or are there residual proceeds left over at the end of a given year?
So, Commissioner, I'm going to answer your question and then let Carrie Wendell jump in and correct any misstatement I make. Important clarification is we do not, as a district, give Helping Hands the funds now. Helping Hands is a program that's established pursuant to a specific statute, RCW 5452-010, I think, that gives the district and other utilities, PUDs, the ability to receive funds donated by customers and put those funds to use for the benefit of the low-income folks who need those dollars or that assistance. And that can actually be through a program that we have, which is administered by a third-party not-for-profit, or it could be one that the district could administer. The district chose back in 1990 to actually establish it pursuant to the relationship with it, which it has with the current administrator. So just a point of clarification, those are dollars that the district does not contribute. Those are dollars that customers contribute. The answer to your substantive question is no. I don't believe that the funds are dispersed annually to the maximum, and my understanding is that there's a current outstanding balance north of $75,000 in that fund. Carrie probably knows the specific number. So those dollars just carry over year to year, Commissioner, at this point. And it's built up to that north of $75,000 residual balance.
Thank you.
Other questions? Then I'll just, again, invite commissioners who have any questions, comments, concerns, ideas. Please feel free to call anytime on my cell phone. And I'll turn it back to Andrew.
Thank you, Eric. Well, you must have gotten it all right. Carrie didn't jump in. So now we're in the summary, and slides 16 and 17 provide us with a summary of the information we've heard. What we've heard is there are a large number of individuals, small businesses that are suffering some sort of economic harm due to the state shutdown. There are new federal and state programs that are designed to provide relief, including funds for utility bills. There may be a timing issue between when it's needed and when they actually can get it. A startup for the programs is slow relative to the immediate need being felt. Moving on to 17, there are no current Chelan PUD programs targeted at commercial customers that help reduce their bills. So there's nothing that we have available at this time for them. And then while the Helping Hand account is currently well-funded, we may not likely need some replenishment or to establish alternative fund using PUD funds. These are things that will be looked at in the very near future. As Eric mentioned, the devils are in the details about how those things can be implemented and ensure that they stay within statutory authority. So our next step, slide 18, as Steve mentioned earlier, we're going to extend the moratorium on late fees. We plan to extend the moratorium on late fees and disconnection actions through the end of July 2020. We're going to explore the development of small business bill forbearance or forgiveness program for businesses impacted by the COVID-19 shutdown. Potentially increase scope of Helping Hand or develop a new program to support customers impacted by COVID-19. And then if there are two programs, we'll need to make sure that we answer questions around how to market Helping Hand. The last bullet is really to avoid customer donor confusion of that program and make sure we do that right. So that will open up to questions, comments, input. From the presentation for us as we move forward in the next few days of looking through this information and moving forward with looking at programs.
So, Andrew, this is Steve McKenna.
Yes.
I know in the grant program, and it's been pointed out to us from the federal small business loans that keep their employees, there's a utility component where they can add that to the grant. So just as you explore the development of forbearance, keep us informed of, how that intertwines with what the federal government is doing for small business too, if you would.
Absolutely, and you are correct. There is language within the federal program that allows for utility expenses to be covered within that. Again, I think it's maybe a timing issue of what's needed now versus what they'll get in the future and what they could have available to potentially pay back in the future. Those sorts of things, and we will definitely be keeping the board informed of. Of ideas and options that are being thought about and generated.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm probably not going to articulate this well, but as we look at anything that we do, is there a first step? kind of a tiered process where they, where the PUD looks at, did they qualify for those federal grant dollars? And then if not, you know, then there's another tier where, you know, we may have to investigate those options of forbearance at a later date. But that's what I was thinking of. But I'll look forward to hearing more on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Steve, right? Do you have any anything you'd like to add? Through this?
No, we're just at that point to see if there's any comments to, or guidance the board would like to offer to us.
This is Steve. It just seems like you're on the right track and continue to keep us informed and discuss as we continue to see how the whole COVID thing progresses and what the needs are.
Steve, this is Randy. I think generally we are on the right track. An observation based on the entire presentation is that what we as the utility can do probably doesn't address the immediate need that has been outlined, and that's the timing. Well, we can address it because our forbearance is a huge thing. Allowing people time until other resources begin is a really big thing that we can do, and we already are doing. And I think that's important. I think recognizing exactly where people ultimately are going to land in the financial sphere will become clear in the next month. And that may really clarify the picture for what we need to do or don't need to do going forward in addition.
Thank you, Randy.
Any other thoughts?
Steve, this is Gary. I'd like to just chime in here for a moment. And I feel that we are on the right path. I will share perhaps with my fellow commissioners some of the things that I'm witnessing as I follow the economy, read publications in the American Banker that I find somewhat disturbing, more on a long-term, short-term impact current, but something that might last well throughout the next 2020 anyway. Banks seeing looming concerns, tightening their loan requirements and loan standards, basically making it more difficult to get loans. Some large banks, J.P. Morgan said they are only going to issue government-guaranteed loans going forward for the next short while. And a very interesting article in American Banker. I was aware of the automobile loan crisis that is taking place in America, similar, not quite to the same magnitude as the mortgage crisis back in the recession of 08. But risky loans are up 43% in the last 5 years. They now total $1.3 trillion. The New York Fed released figures saying that 4.6% of all automobile loans are beyond 90 days delinquent. And so when we think about rate relief or what it is the utility might do, we need to think in multifaceted ways that if we provide rate relief, that might allow somebody to take those dollars that they were going to spend on the utility bill and apply it towards a car payment so that they can get to work once things open up and work is offered to them again. So I think that there's a great deal of opportunity ahead of us, the ways we can help residents in our county. And so I'm anxious to continue to follow what is taking place and the thought processes that everyone has discussed today. And personally, my own personal opinion is this, I don't think this is one and done. I believe that until there's some type of vaccine, we will see an ebb and flow of this virus. What that means specifically, I do not know. But it is something that certainly is impacting and continues to impact at a very high level residents of the county through their jobs, small businesses as well. So I'm pleased to see this discussion. I'm pleased to hear the participants today. And with that, I'm going to be quiet. Thank you.
So I don't know if this is the moment. This is Randy. I don't know if this is the moment in time to talk about what I see looking at it down the road. But Gary alluded to something that I think is really important for us to all consider. This issue will not be behind us, in my estimation, until we have the vaccine. Now, what will it look like over the next 12, 15 months before we get that vaccine is a whole other story. And I, tongue-in-cheek, sent an email to Steve Wright this morning saying that my estimate of what would constitute a winner in this scenario is somebody that bought stock in the company that actually had the ability to manufacture an infrared thermometer that you hold up at all the events that people are going to want to go to this fall. Because I think the next 12 to 15 months is going to be a series of fits and starts, and I think Steve had a graph showing the bouncing of new infections going forward once we start opening up. And our society for the next 1 year plus is going to look a lot different until we get back to any sense of normalcy. And I think I'm just supporting what Gary said, that we've got a long road ahead of us, and what we can do as a utility or residents of Chelan County, I think, is work with them in any way we best can. And what you've outlined here today, you know, who knows what tools we will really have to use. I'm looking forward to the next discussion, because one huge tool that I think we can use is we're going to talk about with our fiber optics and the creation of hotspots. I think that's a real biggie for the people of Chelan County. So I'll just stop there.
Thank you. Would any other commissioners like to add additional thoughts for us? Let me do a quick summary of what I think I've heard, because this is guidance. We will be meeting even this week to talk about how we take next steps to advance this based on the outcome of today's conversation. I think we'd start from a couple of comments that we heard, is that the economic problem is not likely to go away for a while, that we may well be bouncing through this recovery period for 12, 18, or more months. So we should be thinking about this in terms of not just what's our response in the next 30 days, but what's our response likely to be as this goes on for an extended period of time. I heard at least a few times that we're on the right track, and on the right track I think means looking at this idea of going beyond forbearance and thinking about rate relief, but how to use that in a way that will be effective. I think Steve said that was clear with respect to thinking about the tiered process. What federal, state dollars do individuals or businesses qualify for, and then play off that to try to make sure that we're really thinking about what's the impact of folks on the ground.
And I heard that expect to see more clarity in the next month or two as to where this economic situation will fall out. So coming back in that time frame, I think, gives us a little bit of time to gather our thoughts, too, about how we develop a strategy that's hopefully going to be one that will work for the longer term.
Can I jump in here and suggest one more thing for the topic team to consider? And that is, if the federal government and even state governments are providing utility relief, that will undoubtedly require some type of documentation. And I'm going to make an assumption that there are those in the county that might have difficulty with whatever that documentation requirement is. And perhaps if the topic team would consider does the district have resources that can assist individuals to complete that documentation?
Okay, got that one too. Anything else commissioners would like to offer? Okay, good conversation. Thank you so much. We appreciate that. I am looking at the clock, and I'm worried. We have 10 minutes till noon. I texted Mike about a half an hour ago and asked if he could move his Hot Topics presentation this afternoon, because it was actually on the agenda twice, in effect, because he's coming up as a resolution later this afternoon. That would work for him. So I'd like to get started on the presentations from our managing directors about what's going on in their business areas right now. With that, I would suggest that John Stoll start us off.
Good morning, commissioners. John Stoll, managing director of Customer Utilities. Everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, yes, I want to touch on a few things. Steve had asked us earlier last week about areas of our business unit plans, district performance plans, that what would be the top things that we are seeing impacted due to the working conditions that we're under. The two that I pulled out, one had to do with our fire risk mitigation strategy that we put on the district performance plan. Simply, we had planned to gear up more resources to address a little more aggressive tree trimming planning this year. And again, due to those restraints, we feel we won't hit that goal to the level we had planned. The other one is more at the business unit level, and that's just achieving our work plan. We had a very aggressive list of projects, both capital and O&M, and clearly, that will be threatened to meet that level of work that we had anticipated, again, just with the situation that we're in. And really, our work plan feeds a lot of other measures that are on the district's performance plan, the reliability, addressing some of the large capital projects that we've identified and called out specifically. So those were the two that really looked at and said, yeah, those are the impacts right now. Switching gears, wanted to talk a little bit about the work groups and customer utilities, and when we're looking at the efficiency levels that we're operating under. I looked at my field workers. These are the emergency response folks. I have about 70 of them, and they're through our line operations group, our substation group, water, wastewater, and I included forestry, even though they're primarily contracted resources. When I look at the efficiency of these groups, and again, they are working, but it's really on critical efforts maintaining essential utility services. Our line operations group, we're at about 25% efficiency. That's the same amount for the substation group as well. However, when we look at water wastewater, they're closer to 50% just from the standpoint that they can do a lot of work or more work maintaining the social distance. The wastewater plants, for example, they're sole operators that work there by themselves. And again, that work is more conducive to, maintaining the social distance. From the forestry aspect, they're operating about 30% efficiency of what we had hoped for. Again, a lot of that had to do with the fire tree trimming and mitigation efforts. Then I look at the other areas, more of the back office, the customer service, the engineering. It's interesting. Carrie's group, for example, the customer relations group, I'd say they're north of 100% just with everything they're dealing with and what you've heard this morning. Lots of calls. They're having to manage a brand new system. And frankly, we hadn't planned to be in this. Nobody could have predicted we would be under these circumstances. So there's a lot of issues they're having to manage daily on top of the customer issue. Looking down the rest of the groups, I'd say our system engineering is at about 80%. Our customer service engineering is about at 80%. We have a technical office working on the AMI project. They're closer to 90%. Again, a lot of that work can continue on. So overall, I'd say when I just would balance that all out, we're probably looking at about a 60% efficiency for the entire business unit at what we're operating at today. Now, that being said, we are beginning, as Steve has mentioned, to look at if we're entering a new phase, what type of work can we bring back? Again, everybody's working. They're just on more of a non-standard shift and working when needed. But are there key priority work items that we can begin to bring back? Again, if we can maintain the proper social distancing, have the proper personal protective equipment and sanitization supplies on hand. We are beginning those discussions again, trying to bring at a little bit more work. And I'll use the line operations group as an example. What does that mean? What we're really challenged with is doing anything hot. Normally we do a lot of hot work where the lines are energized. There's a lot of close proximity. So that type of work will be a real challenge going forward until the social distancing requirements are lessened. But there is other work we can do. We anticipate maybe in the future some critical line extension work, provided the governor's prohibition on certain activities loosens up. We've got some underground cable replacements, pole replacements. A big-ish effort is getting back to doing some reliability measures and hardening the feeders. What I mean by that is replacing elements like bird guards, animal guards, older cutouts, things of that nature. And again, going through the rest of the work groups, they're all looking at the type of activity that would be very valuable work. It would be prioritized. But again, really trying to step back into this and doing it very smart. So I'll stop there, see if there's any questions. And under that, I'm pretty much done with my report.
Kirk, are you up next?
I am. So this is Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. I'll follow a similar approach to John. As we enter the second quarter, we've taken a look at performance plans and the biggest impacts, three areas that we've seen so far is first one being the hydro capability improvement projects. We had planned to return 8 units to service this year. We have already completed 2 of those units. The next 6 units include C2 and C7 trunnion bushing replacements. Those are experiencing at this point in time at least a 4-week delay. And then the units at Rock Island, Powerhouse 1, B3, B4, B7, and B10 are experiencing at least a 6-week delay at this point in time. Second area that's seeing quite an impact is just our normal preventive maintenance plans at the hydros, Rocky Reach, Rock Island, and Lake Chelan. In order to minimize exposure to our hydro operations personnel, our emergency personnel, we've greatly reduced all of that work inside the powerhouse. And then the third area of impact is the work we had to harden the transmission lines against fire and weather. We postponed the outreach efforts in Leavenworth Plain and Lake Chelan. Looking at our efficiency rates, we have, borrowing a term from Andrew Gazelle he used earlier, kind of a tale of two cities. The biggest work groups that have been impacted are the central maintenance, wiremen, and mechanics, and then the Rocky Reach, Rock Island plants. personnel again. Great limitations on work, what work is done inside the powerhouse right now. Central maintenance wiremen and mechanics are roughly around the 10% efficiency rate. Rocky Reach, Rock Island plant personnel are around the 63% efficiency rate. And then we have a number of other groups that are closer to 90%. That includes the business office, central maintenance technicians, hydro engineering, and the transmission and compliance staff. And similar to customer utilities, when you add all that up and the number of people, we're looking at overall about a 60% efficiency rate. Those numbers do fluctuate on any given day depending on troubleshooting and emergency response type items. And then likewise, we are looking at this week and how we can begin performing some of that work we are delaying. Looking at the priorities and then making sure we have the appropriate personal protective equipment on hand and protocols to maintain social distancing. And I'll end it there and open it up to any questions. And if there aren't any, Mike Coleman's next.
Maybe we'll take questions at the end. Mike, would you jump in?
Okay, I'll be glad to. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. And when I look at the impacts the pandemic is having on the fiber and telecom business unit, I focused on three of the big ones. The first is the expansion. We're currently not proceeding with expansion due to resources and working conditions that often require close working conditions with both fiber and electrical employees. Second one is customer service, installations, and repairs. We are building a little bit of a backlog on both installs and repairs. We're prioritizing repairs based on true outages versus just degraded services. So we're getting the outages worked, and we're getting a lot of the degraded services worked, but we're still building a little bit of a backlog on the repairs. Last one is the portal replacement project, one of the technical roadmap projects on the district performance plan. The pandemic crisis hit just as we were getting ready to kick that project off in full gear. We changed and we're moving forward in a virtual mode, but it is slower and less efficient than on-site work. We're taking steps to move it as fast and as far as possible, given the circumstances. At this point in time, we still cannot determine the full impact on the schedule, but both ourselves and crews each day to gain maximum separation. They're probably in the 20 to 25% range, and I'll come back to that in a minute. When I look at the staff, probably in the 80% range. There are limitations with remote access, and we all understand there's a difference from face-to-face work processes to remote, non-face-to-face processes, and it does lower the efficiency just a wee bit. Our network admins are probably operating at 100% plus, but they're very, very accustomed to doing remote work and can do all of the necessary work remotely on the network. They simply need the field crews to support them in certain work activities. Our telecom engineers are probably in the 50% range. Some activities require field visits, and it requires collaboration with other work groups, and they're just unable to perform that. They are filling in their time and getting as much productive work done as possible, but there's some work we're having to defer until we relax the social distancing requirements. Like the other operational business units, we are evaluating. Given all of the information, the new guidance, and the safety practices to do work, we are going to look at and start very quickly to move back to having all three of the crews in on a daily basis. We will maintain a staggered shift schedule, though, And that still gives us our better separation while they're in the office, both in the morning and the afternoons when they come in. Our expectation is that overall we will move, ramp back up towards a 50 to 60% efficiency level and then try to improve that as we get better at it. So with that, I'll see if there are any questions, and if not, pass it on to Justin Erickson.
Let me jump in real quick. We're past noon. I'm guessing we have about 15 minutes of material left in this presentation, so I want to check with the board. Would you prefer to just plow through this and go ahead and get this part done, or would you like to take a break and come back to it in the afternoon?
Commissioners, what are your comments?
I wonder if everybody already went to lunch.
So this is Ann. I'm happy with either. Doesn't matter to me.
Should we try to push on and complete this section?
That's fine with me, Ann.
Randy, Steve, Dennis?
There'd be an advantage from our point because it allows folks to get freed up to move on to other things, too.
I'm fine with it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, let's just move forward and complete this section.
Okay.
All right, Justin.
All right, well, good afternoon. Now, Commissioners, Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. From just a general perspective, about 75% of individuals in District Services are working from home. Our overall efficiency level department-wide is around 70%, we estimate. So in looking at kind of our 2020 work plan and identifying things to discuss today with you, I wanted to focus in on our facilities projects since that occupies a broad body of work and some multi-year projects that we have going on. So I'll just walk through each of them very briefly so we can and move on quickly. With Rock Island, work is able to continue with social distancing practices in place. COVID-19 schedule impacts are presently expected to be in the three-month range, and we'll continue to monitor that. That could certainly be extended depending upon what happens. We do think there may be some related cost increases, and those are still under review, and I hope to provide you more details at a future update relative to that. With our Rocky Reach project and CM facilities there, we had recently considered bidding that work in a couple of different phases. So we were going to start in the next couple of weeks with a structural steel bid to do some of the initial work and then do a phase three, which would be the building packages, later in the summer. We've decided with the current bidding climate it makes sense to bid those together in the summer since there's so much uncertainty right now. And so hopefully that will the bidding environment will stabilize somewhat by kind of the August timeframe. So you will not see us bidding any of that work at present. We do think from a time perspective, the overall impacts from COVID-19 are about 4 months delayed. And then with the service center, things are relatively on schedule there. So we're, of course, wrapping up a lot of the design and bid packet work. We do anticipate having our first bid packet ready in early summer for the ground improvements and civil site work, so and the grading and infrastructure work that needs to be done. We are, in discussing with our GCCM contractor, Absher, they're reporting high interest and a lot of competition for bids currently on some of their other projects that they're engaged with in the Northwest. So hopefully as we look towards kind of the midterm time perspective and thinking about this project further along with our guaranteed maximum price, which we were hoping to obtain in December of this year, hopefully the bidding climate is favorable and we might actually realize some benefits further down the road. With maybe projects elsewhere that that are on hold or not going to occur with COVID impacts. So so those are the three projects, and I'll leave it there and for any questions that you may have. All right, thank you, commissioners.
Commissioners, this is Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources. I'm going to first talk about the projects that we know of that are going to be impacted by the COVID-19 issue. First and foremost is that our group is down about 20% of our staffing. We were in the process of hiring and posting new jobs associated with that, and the delay in the issues associated with COVID-19 is very difficult to go out and hire people during this these times. We did hire one individual just before April 12th, and he has been running and being trained virtually. Nobody in our group other than the people that interviewed him have seen him yet, so that's a rather interesting perspective. And then the other job openings that we currently have are going through the approval process, and but it's a little bit more complicated getting those posted, and not sure what the response will be on those. As far as the projects that are impacted by all of this, first and foremost is in Andrew Grissel's group under the Customer Energy Solutions. There are energy efficiency goals and stretch goals that we have out there, and since a lot of those customers are not up and running, a lot of the energy efficiency goals are going to be impacted. And then the other one is in Stehegan. We were going to be issuing an RFP for battery technology in Stehegan, and that's been delayed based on the current situation as well. I'm not going to get into any of the other programs or projects that are deleted so, or that are affected so far. Regarding productivity and efficiency of our group, I polled everybody on our team and asked them how their individual productivity was and how the team productivity was. For individuals, it went as low as 65% efficient all the way up to 110%, depending on who the individual was. I found that the two people with the lowest efficiency rates had a lot to do with having several kids under the age of 10 at home with them, and that was impacting their efficiency and ability to work from home. I think families are adapting to the new working from home policies. And then overall, the individuals on average were about 85% efficient, and then the teams as a whole were about 95% efficient. So with that, I'll pass it along to the next presenter.
Thank you, Greg. This is Kelly Boyd. I'll pick it up on addressing finance, risk, and IT. Our overall efficiency is at about 85%. We have a handful of people on site, but for the most part, we're able to work well remotely, just not quite as efficiently. In addition, we've redirected the focus of a large portion of our IT resources to support remote usage and other COVID-19 activities to support the workforce. You know, an example being developing an employee webpage. So we are focused on priorities, not on the original plan. Accordingly, our primary goal that is falling behind is the execution of the technology roadmaps and the sub-goals that feed the roadmaps. The roadmaps involve many groups across the district, and we all rely on each other and are intertwined on our tasks. While some departments have been able to progress as planned, others have not. So when we get back to normal, we will need to regroup, realign, and reschedule our roadmap milestones to ensure that we are doing the precursors and interrelated actions in the right sequence. So I do anticipate that we will be extending our timelines and resyncing the technology roadmaps for 2020. And with that, I'll pass it on to Tim.
Good afternoon, commissioners and others. Tim Pettit, Director of Safety, Health, and Human Performance. As our priorities are, of course, the employees here at the district and their safety and health, our focus has really shifted with so many employees working from home or unavailable to be here at work. But that definitely doesn't mean that we haven't been efficient or effective. some of those effects that have really detoured our plan, actually, and for the district's plan, is our goals for our human performance improvement and our roadmap and a number of initiatives that we had going that were district priorities. With the COVID-19 effects, those have all been put on the back burner at this point in time as we continue to learn how to move forward in this kind of new world that we're in. When you look at the efficiencies and effectiveness of the employees, as echoed by some others, what we've really recognized is when it comes to a few of our employees, their workload and effectiveness, although direction has changed, has been greatly increased. One of our employees is on the board at Confluence Health. Another one of our employees has picked up taking care of all the ICS needs as far as the minutes and planning. And so if it's one place we may be down just a little, it would be in all of our safety coordinators that are in the field interacting with crews most of the time. We have been rotating them in and out of their shifts here at work. And while they're working from home, they're focusing on how are we going to move forward in the future and actually catch up on a number of things that we're going to need to address. Compliance is a huge focus for us, and a lot of our compliance involves personal face-to-face contact with people, with our first aid, CPR, and a number of others. So a lot of time is being spent on, if this continues, how do we address all of those needs in a different fashion? So although we've been rotating them, I would say that the effectiveness and the efficiencies are at a very high percentage right now. As of today, as we begin to ease into what this looks like to bring employees back, the entire safety and health team is on site today. One of the things that makes that capable is they all have separate office space and pretty good office space, with that to be said, and we want to be here and be available for supervisors, managers, employees, and anyone who may need information or assistance as we move forward and, as I said, ease into this new venture that we're on as we start to get back to work here. Hopefully we get back to some sense of normalcy over the next couple of months. Any questions at this point in time, commissioners?
Thank you, Tim. Lorna?
So I would estimate overall HR productivity at about 70%, but even in a small group, the impacts are really different function by function. I'd say payroll is at about 70% productivity, and that's with technology working well for actually processing payroll, and that's probably at about a 90% level of productivity compared to usual. But the payroll manager has spent any of her time that's not devoted to directly processing payroll on analyzing recent legislation from both the state and federal levels, so programming in the payroll system can be changed to support the new mandate. And, of course, payroll is answering a lot more questions than usual about how to report time and so forth. Also, the IRS has just shut down its customer service lines, just as countries' payroll departments are filing their regular annual and quarterly tax reports and trying to implement the new federal legislation and related tax credits. So I don't know if that's going to impact us or not, but it might if we can't get answers. Recruiting efficiency is probably also at about 70% for now. We've experimented with different technologies for conducting various parts of the process remotely, including using Skype and Teams for collaboration and creating new electronic review and approval processes. Most hiring managers, though, aren't willing to make a job offer without actually meeting the candidate in person, and as a result, we're taking processes to the point where we would normally bring a candidate in and then we're pressing the pause button on the process until the time when the candidates can travel again and meet us face-to-face. That's having two results. One is we're going to have a bow wave of on-site selection processes to conduct once the stay-at-home order is lifted. And we've already experienced getting fewer candidates applying and having some applicants withdraw due to the uncertainty around various things. Also, our competitive advantage in recruiting has been our high-touch, highly personal approach, and that's kind of suffering under the current circumstances. In benefits, efficiency is probably about 90%. A lot of business was conducted in person before, but that's pretty much as efficient by email or phone, and most of our business with our benefits and investment vendors and consultants was already primarily by email or phone. But we are receiving more questions than usual, and they're requiring lengthier discussions typically. In compensation, efficiency is probably about 80%. That's mostly because remote access is slower and sometimes challenging, and we've experimented with various collaboration technologies to share and explain complex information remotely so decisions can be made. And also we've been spending some time developing digital materials and electronic workflow for approvals. That's taking time now, but should create ongoing efficiencies. Similarly, in our information and administrative systems, overall efficiency is maybe 85%, but we have really been using this time with those people to replace manual processes with electronic processes that have been our goal for some time, but with our general busyness, it often takes a back seat, and now we've got a burning platform, and we're starting to make progress on some of those. In labor and employee relations, overall efficiency is maybe 50%. I've been spending close to 40 hours a week on COVID-related issues. Brian and I have been participating on the ICS team and performing follow-up regarding that kind of thing for about 20% of our time. And Brian and Wendy have had to spend time negotiating letters of understanding for more flexibility with work rules for our union employees and alternative schedules, working through sequester scenarios, including work rules and pay for that. And, you know, we're trying to continue ahead with performance management issues, which is a little difficult, to normally we do those kinds of investigations and follow-up conversations in person, so we're having to do that remotely, and it's just not quite as effective. Areas of the performance plan that might be impacted, item 61 was a high priority. That was a P1 priority, and it's metric to fill 90% of our 24 new positions. So if we're unable to hire more than two of those new positions, we'll miss this metric. Well, we currently have 63 jobs on our radar screen, and that's always a changing number. That doesn't include students and seasonal positions. We recently asked managing directors to prioritize their current hiring needs, and for filling existing positions, we're typically prioritized higher than filling the new positions. In fact, 18 of the 24 new positions were not on the high priority list. And we have lots of hard to fill positions on that list. So with linemen, those have become very, very difficult to fill recently. We added a new crew, that's four linemen and a foreman, and we also had two vacancies already. So that alone could keep us from meeting the metric. And other hard to fill positions are likely to be IT director, safety HPI director, energy structuring and trading director, river planner, telecom engineer, and many, many more. And then implementation of diversity strategies, that's item 6F1, it's a P3 priority. It might be delayed because of the district management is currently busy with COVID response, and then later in the year, recruiting and district management will be dealing with the bow wave that we're creating by pausing selections right now. Employee development goals are also likely to be delayed. That's items 6D1, 6D2, and E6E1. Those are all P3 priorities. The recruiting of the learning and development program manager has been delayed due to lack of availability of district managers to participate as selection team members. So a delay in hiring that position is likely to delay the items related to leadership and employee development. We're still on track right now with item 5P. That's a P3 priority related to identifying our top three benefit solutions. But we are also delayed in starting the process to backfill our benefits position, and that might delay us later on with taking a step toward moderating the healthcare cost curve. That's everything I have. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Move on to Eric. We'll take questions at the end. Eric?
Sure, Commissioners, thanks. So we have two groups, the lawyers and then the audit support. I would say that efficiency is high in both, probably in the 80% range, maybe a little bit higher. Fundamentally, the lawyers have simply shifted much of their attention from the day-to-day project working to support other business units to COVID response issues, although we're still managing as many projects forward as we can. And then from the audit and compliance side, they are still meeting all of their objectives. They've simply shifted their attention from in-house audits to completing some of the paperwork that they've been working on periodically. Our entire team is working remotely with the exception of needing to come in for either these things to pick up materials or to review warrants and AP. That's all I have.
Commissioners, I think you can get a sense from that that, you know, probably we're in the 60 to 70% range of productivity right now, but it's a huge variation across the district with some parts down at 25 or 30 and some at 100. And so the impact is just not uniform across the district in terms of our ability to accomplish the performance plan. We wanted you to have a sense of how work is being impacted. So as we move through the year and are discussing the performance plan and priorities, we're going to have to make some trade-offs in the second, third quarter with respect to what are the highest priorities for the district. Now, open it up for any questions. Okay, well, I appreciate your hanging in there with us and allowing us to get that done so we can release some folks to get some other things done.
Steve, this is Ann. It takes me a minute. I have to unmute. And I just really appreciate that report. I just kind of really tune in. And well, not that I'm not always tuned in, but, no, I that's really useful information. Thanks for that. Thanks for it to everybody. And thank you to all the directors and everybody for your yeoman's efforts on this. I can only imagine, you know, what Lorna, what you're going through and your staff and Mike. And so anyway, thank you.
Yeah, it's very much appreciated, everybody's efforts.
Commissioner Arsenault, I would leave it to you as to what time you would like to start the afternoon session.
Well, Commissioners, do we have a request? I'm looking at the clock. It's almost 12:30. Would someone care to make a request as to what time we would start the next session? Do we feel that we could conclude a quick lunch and be back on schedule at 1 o'clock? Is that possible?
That works for me.
Works for me.
I like it, Dan.
Oh. Yeah, no, okay.
All right, so we will start back up at 1 o'clock, and this is a moment when I open up phone lines to the public. Anyone who might be on the phone who wishes to make a comment, please state your name, your address for the record, and please be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes. Is there anyone on the phone, a member of the public? Hearing no public making comments, we will recess for lunch and begin our business session at 1 o'clock, which is approximately 30 minutes.
Welcome to the April 13th, 2020 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility Commission meeting. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in this morning or this afternoon. In the spirit of social distancing and due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone line are encouraged to make comments and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will be opening up the phone lines at the very end of today's session for public comment. So, commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
This is Randy. I would move that we accept the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
This is Steve. I'll second it.
The moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. The consent agenda carries. Steve, would you like to pick up where we left off?
Yes, so that brings us to regular agenda item 10. This is a resolution accepting the bid of Transco Industries Incorporated of Portland, Oregon, bid number 19-86, to provide the Rocky Reach Intake Headgates project and approving a capital budget revision for the project. We'll probably take a little bit more time on this one than usual because this project, the bids came in above what we were expecting, so we've had to do some additional work to think through the economics of this. I'm going to turn it over to George Velasquez.
Good morning, George Velasquez, Rocky Reach Lakeland Engineering Project Manager. So this one's a little interesting. I think we came to the board for approval to advertise this one. And I'll just run you through a little bit of background. So on slide number two, Rebecca, if you could move to that. If you recall, we have currently we have four sets of head gates. Those four sets include three gates per set. So we have a total of four, 12 individual head gates, which makes up that three. One of those sets is strictly used for emergency use. They have a special design, and they're strictly only for emergency use, such as the runaway turbine unit. Each one of those gates that makes up a set of three is roughly 24 feet wide by about 50 feet tall, and each weighs about 110 tons. Next slide. So currently, I believe everybody's aware that we have shifted gears and we're working on the small trunnion bushing and seal program on the C1 through C7. So if you look at that timeline, that schedule, C2 and C7 are currently being refurbished, with exception of the timeout we've taken due to COVID-19. But those are still scheduled to be completed roughly towards the end of the year in 2020. So that takes up two sets of head gates. And then we will just move consecutively through the program. We will immediately jump onto C3 and C4 and start refurbishing those trunnion bushings and seals. And then on the heels of that, the third set of two, which would be C5 and C6, we would roll right into those. Next slide. So from an operational perspective, these head gates are required for maintenance and repair work. Examples of delaying activity due to not having another set of head gates includes the trunnion bushing servo seal repairs that we have to do, C3 hydraulic blade blocking inspections that we have to do, C10 and C11 blade block inspections that we have to do, C7 seal failure evaluations, and then we also have C9, which was just recently put back in service. We have some inspections on those as well. Next slide. So future needs, we're looking out into the future, and some examples of outages we could anticipate needing additional head gates for. I mentioned some, but in addition to that, trunnion bushing seal failures, wicket gate bushing repair replacement, C10 and C11 blade block inspections. This is dependent on when we get done with C1 through C7 trunnion bushing replacement program. C4 thrust pot heat exchanger replacements. We're currently seeing overheating issues on C4, and we're seeing signs of similar issues on other heat exchanger thrust pot heat exchanger systems on other small units, hydraulic blade blocking of units, inspections on large units, work associated with conversion of water-filled hubs, which we've been talking about, lots more starts and stops with the T-dip procedures and processes that we have to follow, evaluating how our assets are managed, and that approach may need to change. So there would be potentially many more inspections due to just wear and use and cycling of the units. We are continuously discovering additional headgate requirements. These are just the ones we know. There's always reactive inspections. If something happens where we need to dewater a unit, we have to go in and inspect.
Next George, slide. George, what is T-DIP?
It's the acronym. Somebody can help me out with this one, but basically we're required to operate the flows and the output generation in a certain way. And what that causes is...
Maybe let me jump in. Commissioner Smith, it's the Two Dam Independent Project. It's operating...
Gotcha. Without... Okay.
Thank you, Steve. It just causes our units to run and stop and fluctuate and change output a lot more. Slide number six, please. So the economics of it, I think Steve mentioned, the total project cost is roughly $3.7 million, and the contract alone for Transco is about $3.2 million. We ran some internal rate of returns and economic models, and I'm going to allow Kirk Carlson to step in here and discuss those.
You bet. Hey, thanks, George. Yeah, this is Kurt Carlson, Senior Quantitative Analyst at the district. So as George says, we have a total project cost, and that's the one we focus economics on, is $3.7 million. Just as background, we created a discounted cash flow model to evaluate the economics. And in a discounted cash flow model, you look at two streams. One is the cost stream. So the cost stream is the $3.7 million, which is spent up front. The other stream is a benefit stream, okay? And the benefit stream, since it's a discounted cash flow model, is discounted from future times to bring it to present to compare it to the cost and see where you stand, basically. So in our economics, we use a discount rate of 7%. So those future benefits are discounted down at a 7% rate. What we're doing in this evaluation, we're evaluating future benefits where we're actually goal-seeking, I call it, or solving for how many outage days do we anticipate using the headgates, and how many outage days would you need to use the headgates in the future to make the benefit stream and the cost stream equal each other. Obviously, if you don't use the headgates in the future, you're not going to have, you don't have a benefit of actually purchasing the asset. In our evaluation, we're actually looking for the use of the headgates. Well, the use of the headgates implies that you're going to be saving days. In other words, you're going to be being able to get a unit back online sooner. Since if you use the headgate, you aren't able to use the existing, I call it three sets of headgates. So here's a couple observations that we ran the scenarios, and we ran a variety of scenarios out over an estimated 40-year life. And the outage days needed to make the project break even ranged from 2 to 10 days per year, okay? And that variability really was presented by the various things that George brought up as to what we have going on just now, I would say, in the next 2 to 5 years. And if this fourth, I call it fourth set of headgate, is used a fair amount in the next next 2 to 5 years, then over the rest of the life, you won't really need to use the headgates much just to make it break even. But even so, even if we don't need it in the next 2 to 5 years, 10 days per year is the estimate out of the modeling as to how much the headgates would need to be used to make payment, basically on the upfront cost of $3.7 million. Engineering and operations staff have looked at the active needs, and as George astutely noted at the end of the last slide, where we're continuously discovering additional headgate requirements, they're also thinking about what potential future headgate requirements might be need. And obviously, there are some we don't know of, right, at this point. But they're seeing an active need for another set of headgates. And because of that, the economics, based on the way it was developed, are supportive of the purchase.
Thank you, Kurt. Slide 7, please. So staff's recommendation is to seek approval for the budget revision of roughly $965,000. In addition to that, approval to award to Transco bid 1986 in the tune of $3,152,930 for a total project cost estimate of $3.715 million. Any questions?
Good job, George.
Thank you.
Okay. I am back, but are you ready to move on to agenda item 11?
I think so.
Okay, this is a resolution deferring to December 1st, 2020, the first year of electric energy, water, wastewater, and wholesale telecommunication service rate increases adopted by resolution 20-14424. We were not planning a presentation for this. Really just wanted to create an opportunity for the board to ask any questions. Kelly Boyd and Eric are available if you have any questions for us, or myself available if you have any questions about this resolution.
Commissioners, I'd also say that John Stoll and Lindsay are with us in the boardroom.
Commissioners, are there any questions regarding resolution number 11?
Steve, I have none.
Commissioners, good afternoon. This is Lindsay Mons, business manager and customer utilities, and I would like to point out a couple things about this resolution for your awareness as you consider the request of. As you know from reading it, this resolution does request a 6-month deferral for those water, wastewater, fiber, and residential electric services that coincides with the December 1st implementation of commercial industrial rate increases. It does not defer any future increases, which are scheduled June 1st of every year thereafter for the next following 4 years. With this deferral, particularly in the water and wastewater area, it's important to note that it does cause the district not to meet the performance plan goal associated with those systems having a rate in place this spring. So that's one item that will show up as a red for progress on the next quarterly report. And it also could impact the fiber, water, and wastewater system's ability to meet the recently approved financial metrics that the board adopted, I believe, at our last commission meeting. So those are just a couple things for your awareness as you consider this resolution.
Well, commissioners, this was a resolution or a topic that we had at our last board meeting, and I believe it had garnered pretty general good support. Is there any feedback or comments that we can share with staff or with Steve on this resolution?
This is Randy. I guess my comment would be, yes, we did talk about it the last go-around, and for those that might listen to this recording, this is a direct result of what I see as a commissioner as a need to let our community know that we want to do everything we can in this tough time of the COVID-19 to not be tone deaf to the needs of our customers. And we're trying, this is one step in that process.
Well said, Randy. Okay, if there's no further comment or any input, I think we're ready to move on.
Okay, the next item would be agenda item 12. Resolution revising the financial criteria for funding the public power benefit program and establishing initial funding levels for 2020 to 2024. Kelly is here. She may want to offer a comment. I'm not sure, but this is really just implementing the direction we got from the board at the last board meeting after discussing the public power benefit program, recognizing that it could also be used to help with some of the COVID-19 issues that may arise. So it changes the budget amount to $6 million a year for 2020 through 2024 and establishes the financial criteria that will be used as guidance for determining the annual amount.
So thank you, Steve. You took two of my 3 points of this resolution just being the follow-up to the head nod from the last meeting when we did the presentation. It was required to be done through resolution because the previous criteria was established in our 2015 resolution. And there are three items under this. Steve has said two of them. The first one is just revising the funding criteria to enable funding over the long term in alignment with our district financial metrics. The second one is the one that I'd like to emphasize, where it does establish the initial funding levels to be included in the 2020 through 2024 five-year forecast at $6 million per year based on these revised financial criteria. And then also, as Steve mentioned, the third item is that it approves the related budget revision to increase the 2020 public power benefit budget from $4 million to $6 million. And then, just as with our existing practices, we will continue to review annually in case any modifications are needed.
Commissioners, any thoughts, comments on the revised public power benefit funding levels? Well, I'd like to just chime in and say that the timing on this seems to be pretty good. And as you mentioned, it may lend itself to some form of COVID-19 assistance. The form is yet to take shape, but at least the money would be available in that format if we discover a path forward to help residents of the county. So I'm quite pleased. Thanks, Kelly, for all the hard work on that.
Okay, if no other comments, we'll move to the agenda item 13. This is a resolution rejecting all bids and declaring that no bids were received for Rocky Reach C1 through C7 runner support, lifting Link's fabrication bid number 20-13, and authorizing the Rocky Reach C1 through C7 runner support, lifting Link's fabrication be obtained by negotiation. George Velasquez is back up.
Thank you, Steve. So on this one, we went out to bid for two separate pieces of equipment under one bid. That bid was 2013. This is in support of the C1 through C7 trunnion bushing seal repairs. There are a couple pieces of equipment that we need to execute this refurbishment successfully and efficiently. And one of them is a runner support that's used for reassembly, basically lowering the hub and setting it while work is being done to remove it. The lifting links are used for lifting rotor and other pieces of equipment, rotor shafts, safely and effectively. We currently have a set of lifting links, but they have indications in terms of cracks. So we need a new set. The bid that we advertised, there were two bidders that came back. One of them was Voith, the other one was Machinist Inc. out of Seattle area, and they were both in excess of the 15% engineer's estimate. So I'm requesting, in order to stay on schedule and have these pieces of equipment at Rocky Reach ready to use, that we are authorized to reject and negotiate. The two bids were $303,823 from Voith, and then Machinist Inc. was $311,643, both over the engineer's estimate of $250,000. Is there any questions on this one?
This is Steve. Just a quick question. When you renegotiate, is that only with the two current bidders, or are there other options there?
Commissioner McKenna, this is Eric. I'll take that one. The short answer is no. You need not only negotiate with the bidders who submitted. It is a waiver of the bidding requirements, and staff is free to negotiate with those bidders or anyone else.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. If there are no more, we'll move to agenda item 14. This is the item that we deferred from the morning study session. So Mike Coleman will be providing information about this resolution as well. This is an emergency resolution temporarily suspending portions of the district's wholesale telecommunications service rates and to allow the district and district service providers to enable broadband access to telecommunications services during the period of COVID-19 response. Mike?
Okay, Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. I'm going to go back to the presentation that I had this morning, and I'll cover it in a fairly fast manner since it kind of sets up what the resolution is about. I'll give you a second to get back to that. And the presentation is titled Fiber Community Support, Help with COVID-19 Impacts. And the reason we're here is discussing the PUD broadband network support options for both residential and small business support, as well as education and community support. We were planning on coming back this afternoon, but now we're doing it all together. So So when we look at the residential and small business support, by state law, we of course only offer wholesale service. We have no direct connection to the county's fiber users. We serve the internet service providers. And any financial relief from the PUD would have to be broad-based to meet those requirements. Any rate relief would also have to be delivered through the ISPs. The customer support and relief is at the ISP's discretion, not ours. And there are state and federal programs in place to offer ISPs financial assistance. Some of those are listed in the appendix slide, and they very much match up with what Andrew Grissel reported on earlier. When we got to looking at education and community support, we started out with a couple of options, and then we narrowed them down. Option one on slide four would be, and this came about because of requests from the community and the education system, connecting the customers with students and an existing fiber device on the house. There were a number of challenges with that approach. Number one, the crew availability for troubleshooting and installing and getting that many services turned up in a short period of time. It also created challenges with ISP support for doing that many installs. Was only available to customers in existing service territory, creating equity issues, and above all, it was going to be very time-consuming. So we then looked at another option entitled Option 2 here, to create community hotspots at strategic county locations to provide internet access. The benefits, it would be free to the users. It's high impact with the ability to serve many customers in a short period of time, and it's low impact on our crew resources and the ISP resources for implementation. There are some challenges with it. We need willing locations for access points, and we also needed the ISP support. To address that last point, I focused on the retail service providers that generally provide residential and small business service. There's three of them, Localtel, Native Networks, and iFiber. All three of those have committed to wanting to be involved with this program and to provide the equipment to turn up that hotspot on our circuits. We will offer this to all ISPs, but we at least wanted those three in the game with us as we started. So then on slide six, what would it cost? The upfront cost for up to 54 hotspots, labor and equipment for us, is $40,000. That's a conservative estimate on the high end. The foregone revenue for those 54 VLANs would have a monthly VLAN cost. That varies because some of the circuits may be 100 meg circuits, some may be gigabit service. But again, a conservative estimate is $24,000 monthly. And so then I look at how the cost was developed and why there were 54 locations. Generally speaking, there are 9 communities of interest scattered across the county, everything from Malaga to Lake Wenatchee to Chelan, Manson, Eniat. And the number of hotspots required would vary from 1 or 2 to maybe 8 or more. So using an average of 6 hotspots required times 9 different areas gave us a target number of 54. It is quite possible the number deployed could be less than this, depending upon coverage and the use seen on the hotspots as they are deployed. And so we calculated the cost based on a mixture of 100 megabit per second and 1 gigabit per second circuits, and that was simply the best information that we had available at the time. For reference, the cost of 100 meg VLAN, business class VLAN, is $149 a month with a $565 non-recurring fee. For a 1 gigabit per second VLAN, it's $399 a month with a non-recurring fee of $1,125. Our recommendation is that we offer the VLANs at no cost to the service providers who agree to use them for free community and educational access hotspots. It would require a separate service agreement, and the terms and conditions for these particular circuits would be included in that service agreement. The duration would initially be through December 31st of 2020, with the ability to end sooner if conditions permit. And obviously, we're now asking you for approval on this resolution, but I'll stop here for questions on the presentation and then briefly cover the recommendations in the resolution. Any questions?
Randy Smith here.
Yes, sir.
Why haven't you got them up yet? No, I'm joking.
I needed that, Commissioner Smith.
Really curious, looking down the road, and we just approved a fairly substantial increase in our public power benefit program.
Yes, sir.
If this could be something we look at in the future, if there's cooperation with our ISPs as a potential public power benefit, and I have a very specific reason in asking this. I've got a son and daughter-in-law that are both involved in education, and their schools are temporarily suspended. Or they're not in the classroom. School is not suspended. Mm-hmm. School is still in session. My daughter-in-law teaches in a poverty area, and when asking her students how many of them had access to internet to do their schoolwork, 9 out of 10 did not have access to internet. That's hard to believe in today's world. But it's out there. And so in terms of a potential public power benefit long term, I wonder if what we're doing today lays the groundwork for something like that.
Mr. Smith, I want to jump in and take that one. So first of all, my inclination is to believe that even this program is a public power benefit program. This got put together fairly rapidly last week. And there just wasn't time to incorporate all the right language into the resolution that would indicate it as such. I think we should come back to it as we think about the funding for 2020 and additional COVID-19 issues that we take on, that we consider this as a PPB. It's obviously has no revenue, so there's no business case for this project. It's designed to provide a community benefit during a difficult time. Should the board agree with that, and I certainly think there's a question that follows with respect to when we get through this process, what might we do in the future? And I'm going to leave that to Mike, because my guess is he may have some thoughts about that.
Okay. I do have a lot of thoughts about it, but I'm not sure that I have enough information or data to bring those thoughts together at this point. I have had a number of conversations with Russ Elliott, the new director of the state broadband office. I also look at it from the perspective that many of these particular individuals have access to broadband today, whether it's Frontier's DSL, Charter's cable modem service, or our fiber network. The reality of it is, and it's one of the reasons that I tried to create the flexibility in the rates to where the service providers could offer some low-cost packages. Many of these folks either cannot or choose not to afford a fixed broadband connection. There will be a continuing, ongoing need to solve this particular digital divide that we're facing. Whether it's done through long-term hotspots or some other method, we still have to find a solution to it. Russ is very much in agreement with that, and yet it is an extremely difficult question for everybody involved, the providers and the state agencies, to say, do they want to subsidize it forever? And we will be in conversations over the next few weeks with some programs the state is attempting to put together. And I think that we need to gather all of that information and then maybe bring it back for a conversation to say, what does Chelan want to do in Chelan County? And I hope that's an acceptable answer for today.
Absolutely.
Okay. One last point before I do get into the resolution itself. Some of the school districts are already doing it, but we are having conversations because all of the schools literally have the ability to turn up a hotspot at their schools today. They have the equipment, they have the bandwidth, and they have the staff to do it. So we're really focusing these hotspots away from the schools, more into the community, more where the people live. And that way it's going to provide a bigger impact than if we just focused on the schools themselves. With that, I will turn to the resolution. And,
hey, Mike.
Yes, sir.
This is Steve. Before you get move on, just a couple of quick questions. So I'm very comfortable and I like the idea of doing something fairly quickly to provide assistance during this crisis and then evaluating and learning and continuing this discussion down the road. So I have no problem. Excuse me. Just kind of walk me back with a hot spot. Is this a situation where it just becomes closer to their home and so they can, before I even do that, you had mentioned that in order for somebody to obtain this, there had to be a signed contract, but there's no cost there. I missed whatever you said there.
Okay. We did come to the conclusion that it was in our best interest to do a fairly short service agreement with the providers that are offering to partner with us on this. It's essentially a public-private partnership. With that service agreement, though, we would lay out the expectations, the terms and conditions, if you will, both for us and the service providers. This really is a joint offering because even though we have the technical skills and could get the equipment to turn up these hotspots, and I call them hotspots, I call them Wi-Fi access points. They're one and the same. Mm-hmm. However, we don't do this on a day-to-day basis, and we don't operate an access point that directly serves end users. They have the expertise, they have the skill sets. There are issues, as there is with anything, with opening up a network and providing that opening to the public at large, and they have some experience in doing that, and that's why we would much prefer that they be operating it as opposed to the district operating it. But we felt like we needed that service agreement to make the expectations for both of our roles clear.
And then for the end user, that could be, say, if they live close enough, they might be lucky enough to access it. Otherwise, they may be driving their car down the road to the point where they can jump on the Wi-Fi and get access. Is that correct?
That is correct, and we would attempt in every case to make sure that the location would be someplace that, A, they could drive through, there was public parking, that aids in the social distancing. It gives them the ability to drive up, use it, stay in their car safe, maintain their social distancing, do what they need to do, and then get out of there. There are also other issues with public hotspots where people want to go there and camp out. And that's not necessarily a good thing if it's restricting somebody else from using that area. So there's a myriad of details to work through as we start deploying these.
Mm-hmm. For me, in moving down the discussion beyond the emergency at hand, is I'm really interested if this becomes an opportunity working with the ISPs to get out and provide a little bit more service to those that are calling for it, kind of a temporary situation until maybe future partnerships or technology becomes available so that we can continue getting out to people who want that connection but are unable to make it. So just another option I think is a good idea. I'm very interested in that.
Commissioner McKenna, I agree with you. I will also say that there are potentially some sticky issues in that area. If there are, for example, other wireless providers that are not on our network, they may look at us providing the free service long term as a competitive interference. And so we're looking at all of those issues and trying to look at the risk in them and make the best decision possible, not only for the district and our customer owners, but the service providers that are working with us.
Yeah, and I think what I was envisioning down the road that is not necessarily free service, but working through ISP, I don't know if they then, you even have to pay a fee to jump on to that Wi-Fi in a parking lot somewhere.
Right.
I'm very interested in, it's going to be, I appreciate the fact that you're doing this. And I think it's an opportunity for us to learn, and I'm interested.
Okay. Thank you. And we are, we're interested in exploring all of the models and, something that long-term would make sense for both us and the retail service providers. Any other questions before I go into the resolution? Okay. On the resolution, I've covered some of the background. I think we're all well aware of the impacts that the COVID-19 pandemic is causing us. Specifically, the recommendations that we're putting forth today in this resolution is for a partial and temporary suspension to be effective for the services described beginning April 13th today through December 31st. This partial and temporary suspension would affect applicable portions of the district's wholesale telecommunications service rates, which is Schedule 200, which is the virtual local area network circuit schedule. And that enables the district service providers to provide broadband access at no charge to telecommunication services during the COVID-19 response. They would use either 100 megabit per second or 1 gigabit per second fixed virtual local area network circuits to enable wireless Wi-Fi access, otherwise known as hotspots. This partial and temporary suspension may be terminated by further action of the Board of Commissioners before the end of the period of suspension. And number two, that during the period of suspension, non-recurring charges associated with the services would not apply. After the period of suspension, all temporary suspended portions of the district's telecommunication services rate schedules and applicable charges shall become reinstituted in all services, including those newly established during this period of suspension, shall be charged accordingly or discontinued. That's, of course, all subject to change after further conversation. The suspension of rates and non-recurring charges during the period of suspension shall only apply to services by service providers which provide community internet access through designated wireless access points free of charge. All rates and charges associated with all other services, including other services subject to the affected schedules, shall continue in full force and effect and shall not be subject to the suspension during the period of suspension. District staff is authorized to require a separate agreement or acknowledgement from the service providers and establish such additional approvals and requirements deemed reasonably necessary by the district's general manager to implement the provisions of this emergency resolution. And finally, the general manager has reviewed the staff's recommendation and concurs with the same. Any questions on the resolution?
Mike, that looks good. I do have one question for you, just in general. The location, is there a preliminary map on the locations that you're recommending?
No, there's not. Two things. We're coming at it from two different angles. We are compiling a list of suggested locations. We want to collaboratively work with the service providers. It may be that we have a suggested location and they have a business relationship with a business nearby and would say, let's put it here instead. I have proposed, and I'm assuming we will discuss probably later today, that we also offer up some of the PUD locations as a point, because we have parking and public access in the parking lots that would make it ideal for this type of service.
So, Mike, along those lines, for those of us that live in the various communities, what's the distance of a Wi-Fi hotspot? So maybe commissioners could provide you some ideas.
Commissioner Smith, it's going to vary a little bit by the type of equipment that each retail service provider chooses to use. These access points, depending upon capacity and power and bandwidth capability and their radius of service that they can offer, vary significantly in price, maybe from $400 up to maybe $1,800 to $2,000 each. And that is their contribution to this effort. I would say on average that the hotspot would probably have a service radius of 1,000 to 1,500 feet.
That's a good radius.
Commissioners, I would just add that it's unusual for us to bring something forward this quickly, but clearly we're in an unusual situation. There's an awful lot going on, and certainly the concerns about schools and for kids that don't have access to the internet, their ability to take advantage of educational material. So that's why we're bringing it forward this quickly. It's also why, as Mike has described, that we've got a lot of caveats on there in terms of how long it will last. We're going to give this a try and see whether it works and learn from it and then make decisions based on that.
So, Steve, I'd just like to additionally share with that story I started off with about my daughter-in-law. Her students at this point are having to go find the Wi-Fi hotspots so so they can download their assignments. And it's so the Wi-Fi hotspot is important in that setting already.
So, Mike, I have another question for you. Since these are being characterized as temporary hotspots, will there be signage put up at the location that hosts this indicating it's a temporary hotspot? You know, I can imagine that there might be otherwise an expectation that it's a permanent one and we could get some backlash if it was taken down in the future.
We would put up signage. And we would also ask the service providers on their splash screen to convey that information.
Thank you.
Okay.
If there are no other questions, that's it for the resolutions for this meeting.
Commissioners, do we have any other questions, comments, any of the resolutions we've heard? Okay, hearing no questions, is there a motion to accept the resolutions?
Mr. Chairman, I move we accept resolutions as presented.
Thank you, Ann. Anyone would like to second that motion?
I second it.
So it's been moved and seconded. Any questions, comments? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The ayes have it. Steve, it looks like we're moving on to manager items.
We are, and we have just one for you today. Hoping that Justin Erickson and Dan Frazier are in the room to provide an update on the Service Center Trail extension.
This is Dan Frazier. I'm on the line.
Great, Dan. Take it away.
Hey, thank you. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. I had a packet that was sent out with four slides that I'll be referring to in this brief presentation. If you have that, it starts off with large area, aerial of the service center, including the Wenatchee River waterfront area. This slide is really just to give you a kind of orientation of the area we're talking about, and the only thing I want to bring up directly on this slide are the two circles, which are denoted as E, and those are the parking and trail access points that will give our users, our trail users, the ability to park at that point and make their way down to the river. It also orients you with the overall service center itself.
Hey, Dan?
Yes.
I have a question. Are those parking locations large enough to accommodate a school bus for field trips?
So the school bus parking is actually going to be along the street on Old Station Road right down in that area. We're going to have widened parking down there for school buses.
Oh, thank you.
Easier than navigating our parking lot. So if there's no other questions on that slide, we'll get into the close-up of the waterfront itself. Slide two.
Dan, this is Dennis.
Yes.
I'm going to interrupt your presentation for just a minute because I want to lay something out and then come back to it. I want to talk about the stormwater facility. It's on the east border of the property, but let's go ahead with your presentation and then come back to that, okay?
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so slide two gives you a close-up of the Wenatchee River waterfront, and it has the proposed trail alignments, some of the landscaping. I'll just take you through from A to D there. A is the Confluence Parkway alignment. Now, this is an older alignment. There are multiple different versions of this, but they all cross the river at roughly the same location. So when they make the final determination of the Confluence Parkway alignment, that won't affect what we're doing here. B is the railroad the railroad bridge trestle as it currently exists and shows an intersection or an underpass of the trail as it splits between one of the piers under the trestle. And C is what we're calling the viewing area. It's the location of the existing McDougal House, which we just recently purchased. And so that affords a great view of the river area and hopefully a kiosk in that area. We'll get into a little more in the presentation. And then D is the landscaping area. And unfortunately, since we're just in the early stages here, that looks a lot like green grass and trees, but it would be more riparian in nature, some trees and some natural vegetation in that area. And we'd be working moving forward to develop some renderings that look more like what we're going to see there. You also see...
Dan, on D, this is Dennis. On D, one of the things I understand Native American interest has been to reestablish native plants in that area as part of the landscaping project. I don't know if that's correct or not, but I've heard that, you know, that word a little bit.
We actually, throughout the project, are looking for native plants. Even on the service center site itself, we're looking for more native plants. They tend to do better in our climate if they're from here. So that's a great great note, and we'll make sure we have that on the information as we go forward.
Thank you.
So item one and two, if you see the little arrows, those are the two viewpoints, which will be slides three and four. And then right by item two, you'll see a leader and a legend for an informal trail access to the river. These will be more foot trails, not paved trails, that will be used to access the river. In that area of two where you see the splitting of the trail, there's some great low bank access there. And that's one of the things that is not afforded at this point, is any low bank access. So that was a goal of this, was to provide that that way to get in and out of the water. So going on to slide three, that's that shot looking east to the railroad trestle, and you see a kiosk viewing platform in the area of the current house that is there. Gives you a great view shed of the river all the way down to the mouth and the riparian area below the house currently. And the next slide, number four, takes you right down onto that low bank area below the house. It provides that ability to access the water. One of the things that we do see a lot of kayakers and tubers that are looking for a place to get in and out of the water, and this is a location they could do that. Also affords some just day use park area, but more riparian in nature. We don't look at improving this to a beach or anything like that. It would be much more as it is currently, just cleaned up a bit. Are there any questions about the four slides?
This is Commissioner Smith. And just for the sake of my knowledge, going back to, I guess it's slide two, which is the blow up, what's the distance between where you've got the C and the two down there where the informal paths are? How big an area is that?
Oh, that's a few hundred feet. If you remember where the turnaround at the Haran house was, they had a kind of a roadway turnaround. That's kind of in that intersection of the informal trail and the large trail.
Okay.
So from the McDougal house, you're probably looking at no more than 200 feet.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Dennis, again, I just out of curiosity the other day, driving around again, ended up driving down and taking a look at that area. And, you know, I kind of have it's been a while since I've been there, kind of had the impression that there was quite a bit of space down there. And then only to get down there with my vehicle and take a look around and find that it's quite compressed. So it's kind of altered quite a bit of my thinking in terms of what we can do. So So then your renderings come out, and it was like, huh, that's kind of what my adjusted view is going to come out to be. So I'd like to say, you know, I think from my perspective right now, a nice utilization of what available space there is.
Well, thank you for your comment. I think we were trying to give the community something that they haven't had in that area before, which is real Wenatchee River access and a trail that can connect to the Capital Loop Trail and really enhance that area. So while I was here, I wanted to give you an update on what's happening with this. And the reason we're working on this part of the project right now is we're going through permitting. And this becomes part of the permitting process. And we've requested what's called a shoreline conditional use permit and a shoreline master program permit. And we are working with the city of Wenatchee on those right now. And this trail amenity is part of that process. We did receive a completed application notification from the city just last week. It took a little while to get to get all of the I's dotted and T's crossed, but we did get that. And we have our public hearing scheduled for May 26th with the hearing examiner for the city. And then that process goes through, there's a notice of decision and an appeal process, and that goes through the end of June. So we would have final approval on the use of the shoreline area at the end of June. And so additionally, we have site construction permits going on. We're working with Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad to get the undercrossing of the trestle and the trail location permitted, working with the city on Horan Roadway vacation and other site-related site-related permits. There's quite a few to do a project of this magnitude. So that's all going well. It's a little more difficult in the environment we're in now, but we're working through it. We have definitely not put the brakes on the project as we work through our permitting. And then upcoming board presentations. At the next meeting, we plan on giving you an update for the Fifth Street redevelopment planning process. As you can imagine, this epidemic or this pandemic has caused some thinking in terms of what are the economics coming out of this and how do they affect our plan. So we want to do an update on that. And then a presentation about the service center itself. We'll be getting close to seeking permits for site work. And so we'll be coming in doing a presentation on where we are on the overall project in anticipation of awarding what's called a mini MAC or a mini maximum allowable construction cost contract with Absher Construction for the site work. Well, that's all I had, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Commissioners, any questions?
Yeah, I'd like to come back to the stormwater facility. In looking at that thing, Dan, do you know if there's a requirement for how deep that is, or could the depth be altered if it was still enclosed in a fenced area, could be wider? And what I'm driving at is if you cut those banks back and drop that material into the bottom of that stormwater and increase the or maintain the volume of it in a more shallow, would it not be possible to create one or two soccer fields in that stormwater facility that could be utilized for community use?
That's a really good question. I've actually worked on a couple of those type of projects in the past, and we haven't looked at this one because it's a regional stormwater facility, and it tends to get water a little more often than some of the facilities that are very, very seasonal. However, that being said, the city does not their long-term plan for this pond is not very clear at this point. They took over this system with annexation in 2016 and just recently got their stormwater comprehensive plan update out. And this pond, they know they need more capacity in this pond for the long-term use. And so I think what will happen is there'll be a master plan of the pond itself, and they may want to increase the capacity of the pond by going maybe vertical walls and instead of the 3-to-1 slopes that currently comprise the sides of the pond to increase volume. There is a depth requirement because they drain all the way from Chatham Hill over into this area, so they can't go too much shallower without it affecting the ability for the pond to work hydraulically.
Yeah. So, but it could be wider if you went to more 90-degree walls rather than the slope that's there now.
Yeah, there could be some different use, and I really haven't looked at that from a park use because it was kind of narrow. There may be some ability for the city to do that in the future, and one of the things we looked at was possibly capping that for additional space to our yard. It is pretty costly to do that for a stormwater facility.
Yeah, so that would be a city project, not a PUD project.
That's correct. Although we are members of the stormwater utility out there now. And if this was to be a stormwater utility project, we would participate as any other ratepayer would in the project.
Okay, that really helps in a lot of ways. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dan, I have a question. On the upcoming presentation that you discussed a moment ago, will you also be talking a little bit about current thinking on the existing headquarters location?
Yes, that will be the Fifth Street redevelopment will be the April 27th presentation. And so we finished our study back in January and had the final report in February. And it really was based on the economics of, you know, fourth quarter of 2019. And so while they're great ideas, we have to see really what the pandemic has done to the economics. So we'll probably be a little less clear about a path forward, but a little more talking about options and ways we can move forward, and probably just a little more slowly than we anticipated.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no more questions, I would just say that there's a reasonable chance that some of these plans and design work will show up at the Wenatchee City Council over the course of the next couple of weeks as they move forward with us with the permitting process. I wouldn't be surprised if it shows up there or gets some media attention too.
So, Steve, just a question. Should it show up at City Council and we have advance notice, is this the type of meeting that a commissioner should be in attendance at?
Not sure. We've asked, the mayor is managing that process, and we've asked and said, would you like us to participate at some point? He said, not sure, kind of a strong maybe. The explanation was he was going to have some conversations and decide what would be most useful. So if they gets back to us and says, yes, he'd like to have some PUD participation, I think the answer would be yes.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, that's it for manager items for us for today.
Dan, thank you for the report.
Thank you.
Yeah, good report, good information. A lot of legwork went into that one, Dan. Thanks.
Yeah, the team had to kick it into overdrive for a few days to get this put together, but it does a really they did a really nice job, and I think it shows what the potential is down there.
Yeah, looks good. All right, commissioners, if there's no more questions on manager items, commission items are up next. I see that there's a proposed motion. Would someone like to make that motion?
I will make it. This is Steve. I'll move to reschedule the board workshop from Friday, May 1, 2020 to Wednesday, May 13th, 2020 at 9 a.m. at the Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee.
Okay, there's been a motion made. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor of the proposed motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. The ayes have it.
One other commission item?
Yes, please.
Before we move on to commissioners' travel, I just wanted to call out two of my fellow commissioners, Commissioner Arsenault and Commissioner Congdon, for their obvious foresight in knowing that we were going to get shut down in a stay-at-home order because they managed to make it into the office. I'm sure it had to be before the stay-at-home order to sign their receipt for their payroll in the month of February. So I congratulate the two of you, and there's three outliers out there.
Well, that was unexpected. Thank you.
Good job, Ann.
Thanks.
Well, speaking of that, Rebecca, how do you want us to handle signatures?
Right.
I think we're fine just waiting until such time that you come back in the office. They're just going to be waiting for you on your desk, and whenever you're in, you can sign them. No rush on that.
Yeah, what about resolutions and those type of things?
I've gotten signatures from some people as they have come by the office. If I know you're stopping by, I can leave them on your desk. Otherwise, again, they're just hanging out waiting for you to sign them, and I think Eric's going to weigh in on that too.
Yeah, commissioners, Rebecca and I have been talking about alternatives that she's actually done a lot of creative thinking and work on that. So we're hoping to put a solution together here on an interim for you soon. We'll follow up. Maybe we can put that down as a takeaway and follow up at the next board meeting.
That'd be great.
And we'll include resolutions, expense reports, as many other things as we can identify, just for convenience.
Yeah.
Thank you, Eric. I have something for my fellow commissioners on commission items, and we have been requested to supply a commissioner for the radios tomorrow. That would be Cozy and Coho, and I just want to throw it out if anyone is available, if they could let us know.
Gary, I'll do Cozy.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you, Ann.
I haven't done it for a long time. I probably should step up and do that. I'd be happy to.
Okay. And if no one else is available for Coho, I could possibly do that, unless someone else would like to do it. Okay.
I'm unavailable. So sorry, Gary.
No problem. All right, so Ann, looks like you do Cozy, and I will do Coho tomorrow.
Sounds good.
Great. Okay, thanks, guys. So we can move on to follow up on delegation of action items.
Let me do one quick thing just before that. Commissioners, if you would like, because there could be questions about the hotspot issue, although we're not planning to do the release on that until tomorrow afternoon, I think you may want to talk about it. Mike Coleman would be available if you would like him to be available.
I believe, Steve, that Mike is scheduled to be on both of those radio stations with the commissioner.
Okay, good. As long as you, I just want to make sure you knew that.
Great, thank you.
Oh, I think that's great. I'd like to see Mike available. Thanks.
Okay. Action items from the last meeting. Two of them got taken care of in one of the presentations today. There's a request.
Is that the update?
Bowles had asked about the low-income study and if we could show owner-occupied versus renter-occupied for mobile homes. It was actually embedded in the material. I don't think that Andrew focused on it, but it was in there in the material that we provided. And
Eric was looking into if the PUD can make a contribution to the Helping Hands Fund, and you heard his description of that under legal issues today. There was a request that for some information about where the suspended disconnects were coming from. John Stoll sent that out on March 31st, shortly after the last board meeting. And then the last item is one that we have not completed yet, and that's we're still developing the outreach plan for changes to our low-income program as a result of that data that came to us from Empower DataWorks. Any questions about that? Okay. That's it for that item.
So we went back to Commissioner Travel. Okay.
Oh, we are?
Lisa's here and she's ready.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep.
That's okay. She's ready.
I thought you just knew there was not much to report.
There's the update. There isn't any.
Commissioners, I don't have anything on your travel calendar until June 5th for the APPA National Conference, and I believe that's still just up in the air.
Correct.
Did you want to cover anything else?
Not here. I think everything's up in the air until we know what's going on.
Okay. I thought that.
Lisa, I did hear, and maybe Randy, you might know the bottom line on this, but I heard that it was optional whether or not to attend WPUDA later this week. Did I understand that correct?
No. Now that you brought that up, WPUDA is having all of their meetings this week via telephone. They're doing Zoom conference, and they have a call-in line, so they have a full slate of meetings Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. They'll probably be shorter time-wise, but all the meetings are being held, but nobody in attendance.
Thank you for that, Randy.
I thought everybody had that information, so I apologize.
And all those rooms have been canceled.
Thank you, Lisa.
Yeah, Gary, just as I think a point of information following up on Randy's comment, as an example, the Education Committee, they would like one person to call in and be the representative for that PUD, and then others can call in and listen, but they're, I think, if I remember right, are soliciting one respondent. Is that correct, Randy?
That is correct. Thank you, Dennis, for keeping me on my toes, for getting me back on my toes.
I would like to propose then that we designate the individuals that are the designated person for that committee to be on the phone for that committee. Does that sound appropriate?
Yeah, on the phone, or if you can do Zoom conference. My plan, I mean, they're going to do these all Zoom, and I don't know how many of you have or have not done Zoom. But it really changes the meeting because you see everybody's face on your computer and in real time. And I'm going to do, regular board meeting on Friday with a getting to know you presentation as I've been doing. And Mr. McKenna, I'm going to call you after this meeting. So... I think it's well worth giving it a shot if you haven't. Lena sent out instructions.
I saw that.
So, Randy, just...
Back to, I think this year, from my memory, Gary, if it serves me correctly, you're as president, or the lead on the commissioner roundtable, and you're also the chair of the telecom. Steve is on education and communications and I'm energy, and there's water. I don't know if there's a water committee meeting or not. So, but everybody can join the call, though, but just have those of us that know who we are be the vocal participants.
So, Randy, there is no difference whether we all attend by Zoom or by phone, right? I mean, in terms of the delegate doesn't get to do the Zoom and everyone else is supposed to go in by phone.
No, that doesn't matter. The delegate can do phone or Zoom, either one.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, Steve, I think we took a left turn on you, but we're back on schedule.
No, Gary, this is Ann. Sorry, I went to push on mute and I pushed stop. So I just called back in, and there is a water roundtable, and I will be available for that.
Good. Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, so sorry, I jumped ahead on action items, and I've covered item 18 already. So we're up to item 19, which is action items from this meeting. Rebecca, I'll need your help for that.
So, Steve and commissioners, you get me. Rebecca handed this to me. So we have two. The first one, Andy Wendell, will provide additional information on the average commercial bills broken out for small and large customers. And the second is that Rebecca and I will work to determine how to gather commissioner signatures while social distancing measures are in place. And those are the two that we have.
Anything that we missed? Okay, that's it for us.
Okay, I think we're at that moment in time where we would open up the phone lines for any public that might be on the phone to ask specific questions. Again, I would request that you please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. So, Rebecca, would you be kind enough to open up the phone lines?
They're open.
Good. Thank you. Hearing no comments from the public, are there any matters of general business that may be necessary to come before the commission?
Gary, this is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
I'm a little delayed here, but in terms of signing documents, signing, you know, the resolutions and so forth, what I did, I just drove down behind the PUD and Lisa met me outside and put the documents on the picnic tables outside Gerald, and we kept our social distance, and I signed the documents, and then she took them with her and went back upstairs, and it worked really well. It worked beautifully. So just a suggestion that might be an approach.
It's a good system, Ann. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
So we just create, let Rebecca know what our plan is, and she'll set them out for us.
Absolutely.
Good.
I get to do an Audi.
Okay, well, I think we're going to move. We have a need for an executive session in order to discuss legal counsel agency enforcement. Actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board or is likely to become a party and or legal risks associated with RCW, and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by RCW. About how much time will we need?
So, Commissioner, actually, I was trying to catch you before you read the entire executive session. My apologies for that. We do not need the review matters with legal counsel. We are down to, I think, just the performance of a public employee.
Okay.
How about an hour, and we should finish well before that?
Okay, so we'll have 1 hour. It's currently 2:28. We will start at 2:30, and we will call back in. Do all the commissioners have the appropriate phone number to dial in on?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Very good. All right. Then we will adjourn and go into executive session. We are coming out of executive session. It is April 13th, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.